welcome back to another episode of the TetraCast. This is RPG Site's weekly podcast, where we get the site staff together to talk about our favorite genre of video games. We've got the full usual crew here today. I'm your host. My name is Brian Vitale. Joining me, we've got, let's go in a different order. We've got James Galizio.
Hey, folks.
Mikhail Mednani.
Hello.
Josh Torres.
Banana.
Chaman Wu.
How's it going?
And Adam Vitale.
Hello.
All right, I don't think I missed anyone. So, yep, usual crew here. We are recording this in the middle to the back part of July. A little bit of a lull period for RPGs, but not completely. We have a few new games to talk about and a few surprising news things. I think we're just going to get started with the kind of the main release of this week, which is not a game or a series that I know very well, but I do know that certain people in the podcast here are much more familiar with this game and its producer's work. And that is No Sleep for Konami Date from AI, the Somnium Files. This is an interquel that I just released. We got the review up on the site. The review is by Colin Black, and we'll kind of talk about his thoughts because he, for RPG Site, he wrote the review for us. But I do know that James has also played this game. So James will kind of be the site representative in terms of the podcast review, though we did have Colin write it for the website review. So without really further ado, I don't really have much more preamble. I'm just going to hand it off to James to start the discussion about No Sleep for Konami Date.
Yeah, so it's a spinoff. And as an interquel, like pretty much nothing it does really matters in the grand scheme of things. Like for one thing,
I feel like that's a big statement to make right out the front. I'm not saying I disagree, but it's like that's kind of like the thesis of Colin's review, kind of in a way. Anyways, continue.
Yeah, it's like I didn't because of knowing that going in, because even in the best case, you kind of expect that whatever happens is going to get tidied up neat with a bow. Just because, well, wasn't mentioned in the second game, it can't have been that important, or else it just makes retroactively the second game even more. Well, besides this being an interquel, there was also another aspect of it that kind of makes it interesting in the sense that, while I know plenty of people that do love the second I game, myself included, I actually prefer it to the original, a lot of fans were already kind of down on it. So,
I prefer the first game, but I don't dislike the second game. There are things maybe I disagree with, but overall I enjoyed myself with the second game. I guess it's worth mentioning for people, because some people might not be familiar with this game. Like this new entry, No Sleep for Konami Date, is explicitly not a sequel or a follow-up to like the second game. This takes place between the first and second game. So that's for people who don't know, like, hey, what do you mean by interquel? It's like this is not advancing the storyline in terms of like what happened in the events of the most recent entry in that series. So that's why you kind of have this stuck between a rock and a hard place scenario of like what can they feasibly do with this game to for people who may want to know what happens next or what new quote unquote new events that advance it that whole cast forward and that whole world forward.
Yeah. So this is actually my first time reading through Colin's review. I know that him and I kind of agree on most of the stuff. I think the one thing that I would say is that I was definitely a little bit less positive on the game than he was, especially when it came to the character writing. He said that to him, the writing almost bordered on Flanderization with how like the characters were portrayed. And I would say that for me, it kind of crossed that line in some instances. Where I just think that the way that the characters were handled, which again, it's a different main writer, and also the game's runtime is a lot shorter. It's like half the length of the first or second game. So in that sense, it was always going to be harder to write more like a more nuanced plot.
An interesting perspective that I've read about it from other people who've, have had time in the game is like they view it under the lens of like a fan disc sort of game where like, it's a smaller scoped, different angle on like what is now a well-established series for its fans. And some people treat it like, oh, this is like a fan disc entry of that series. And I thought that was a pretty interesting lens to view it through. Mikhail, you wanted to say something?
Yeah, I saw the fan disc thing as well, and I haven't finished it. I've played, like, I think, like, 15 hours, but going through different bits multiple times for the tech article I did, which we'll get to. But I definitely agree with James that it kind of reminds me of, you know how they characterized the Persona cast in the dancing games or, like, in Arena in a way?
Yeah.
And they just overdo. They just, like, oh, I remember Chie used to say this, and then that'll just be the whole thing for the whole story. And, like, I kind of didn't expect it from the AI series, even though, like, if you treat this as a fan disc, I kind of expected better on that front. But I was a little suspect when, you know, when during pre-release interviews and, like, news blasts and all, they said even though this is not a numbered game or this is not a main game, it has enough content to justify being a mainline game or something like that. I kind of knew that wouldn't be the case in the end, but, like, hearing James say it, like, half the length is pretty surprising because I kind of expected it to be a bit longer. But yeah, I haven't finished it yet. I decided to just wait a bit because I got busy with other games. But what I have played, it feels like a fan game in both the good and bad ways, because mechanically they've done some very interesting stuff. I like the escape room stuff, which I'm sure James also likes.
Yeah,
you mentioned
that
before.
I like the escape room stuff, and yeah, I've been talking about this, like, obviously behind the scenes, like, as I'd gone through it. And to put in perspective how long Review Code was out, I finished this before Anime Expo. I finished this in June. They sent out Review Code really early for some reason.
But only on Switch 1 and Steam, to be clear. Switch 2 code was like 2 days or 1.5 days before embargo.
I heard that, like, you know, because of the smaller scoped nature of the game, I think one of the things that I guess some people were surprised about was that this doesn't have, like, one of, like, the trademark features from the previous AI, the Somnium games, which is, like, that branching narrative. Like, it sounds like there's, like, little to no branching paths in this game, where
it's,
you know, in the previous entries. Okay.
Like there's decisions you can make that are, like, an immediate bad end, but they're very obvious what they are, and the game really kind of forces you. Well, actually, I don't know if it even does that or if it's just a flourish, but yeah, it's completely linear. Completely linear.
Okay.
One thing I will say, and this is not actually something I've checked to see if Colin feels the same way, I really like the escape rooms. They're definitely the core aspect of the game that I really like, and it makes me want to see more games like this from this specific team. And it makes sense, especially considering, like, in the opening credits, they showcase, it's like, no, this team is still called internally Team Zero Escape. So
the puzzle philosophy, like, with the escape room is, like, it is markedly different than the previous, because in the previous games you do these, like, the P-syncs, and then where you dive into a person's mind, and yes, and it's more of, like, a puzzle, like a scenario of, like, hey, you're gathering things to proceed to unlock something to proceed with the puzzle forward. And this one, like, when you say escape room, is it like you're stuck in a confined space and you're trying to look for things in the environment get out of? And is it timed like some escape room sequences are in other games?
There are timed moments of it. But also the other thing about the way it works is that the escape rooms aren't timed until you get to right near the very end. And then for, like, the last, like, core puzzle, they're timed.
Okay.
So that's how it works.
I remember the previous ones also had a time, but, like, you could manipulate, like, add on time to them too.
So
they were all
the
fairly, like,
fine. So the P-syncs are still in here. I would actively say that, and this is coming from someone that already wasn't the hugest fan of the P-syncs. Actually, one of the reasons why I think I prefer Nirvana Initiative is I think, by and large, the way that the P-syncs work in that game feel better than in the original the Somnium Files. The way they work here, not a fan. They feel linear, like super, super, like, railroaded and linear in a way that, like, the previous games didn't feel like. And you can just, I don't know.
Would you say, like, it's like, it, like, the quote unquote correct answer is, like, more obvious to you, unlike the other games where you kind of felt like you had more agency over, like, investigating
bit,
how you get to
but,
it?
Yes and no in a weird sort of way where it's like there's some instances where it's super obvious and it's almost like annoyingly obvious. And then there's other cases. And some of this is also a problem in the escape room that I've seen multiple people come to me and kind of bitch about one specific puzzle in an escape room, in which you needed to get a specific password. And the best way to describe it is that if you do not know how, like, the numbers on a digital clock work, you will never understand how the puzzle is supposed to work.
But is there anything on the level like Zero Time Dilemma where you have to, like, learn an alien language to get through puzzles?
No. Nothing like that. But one thing I do really like about the escape room segments, because I'm just not going to talk about the sink stuff, because like I said, I don't think they're very good. I think that the way that are handled here is a bit disappointing. The escape room stuff, one thing that's really neat is that past the first escape room, you get to the point where, you have multiple people in the escape room, and you can switch between them, and there's actually puzzles that revolve around you, like... You can't directly interact with these people, but you can, like, get close to each other and, like, pass over items. So it's like, maybe you get an item in, let's say, Date's section, and then you need to give it to, like, Iris or something like that. There's nothing exactly like that, but as an example, there's instances like that, and it's neat. I do like the idea of it's like, you have multiple, like, separated escape rooms or, like, connected, and you have, and, like, the way that the things you do in one might have an impact in another character's escape room. And that's, like, the most interesting thing about the game, I'd say, by far. So from that aspect, I really do enjoy the game from a gameplay perspective. It's just the story that I think is eh. And then the characters, I think, is... actively kind of bad.
For people, obviously, if you're new to the series, this wouldn't be the one you'd want start with.
Do not start here. Like, I know they tried to say that you could start with Nirvana Initiative, and they were wrong to do so, but they haven't even really beat that same drum this time, because it's just you can't.
But for people who only played, let's say, only the first AI Somnium game, would they be fine going into this game and haven't touched Nirvana Initiative yet? Or would you recommend going through Nirvana Initiative 2 and then going into this game?
I would recommend going through Nirvana Initiative first, because it's a better game. but I do think that if you had to, you could play this and then go into Nirvana Initiative. There's, like, obviously... the events of Nirvana Initiative hasn't happened yet. So there's, like, one or two, like, winks and nods about stuff that might happen, which does give me some hesitance to say it, because it's like, it'll, like, kind of, you'll have, what's the best way of putting it? You'll know that there's something that's going to happen with X, Y, or Z character, even if you don't know what. Which I do think might have an impact on how you view the events of Nirvana Initiative.
Do you think that this serves as a decent bridge, at least, between the first and second mainline games in terms of, like, piecing together of, like, this is how that happened to this character when I saw them in Nirvana Initiative?
Yeah, there's, like, one or two things I do think that it does a good job of, like, kind of taking care of in a humorous way. I do like how... Ryuki, yeah, I do like how Ryuki's in here, but he hasn't gotten the trauma yet, so he's just like basically like a little puppy doing whatever he's told to, and it's really funny seeing that aspect of him.
Our precious boy.
Yeah.
In terms of, like, since it's mostly linear, do they still have, like, features like the notebook where, like, you're still doing some note taking for stuff?
By notebook, do you mean for,
like... It has, like, the characters and taking note of the characters and the descriptions. And how they're connecting?
It does have that.
Okay. Because I was wondering if they're good, at least, like, if they were scaling back features to match a smaller scope, or do you still have, like, some of the features that you've seen in the other game?
I do know that there are post-game, like, skits that you can unlock with the eyeballs. Apparently they're pretty neat. I didn't have any desire to check them out because I wasn't on the review. And to be clear, the whole reason that I even played it is that for some inside baseball, like Spike Chunsoft apparently every so often will just randomly send codes to people on their like PR list. And this was one of those cases. So I did not request it. I just got a code in my inbox. So I was like, I'll play it.
Oh, what do you mean by like unlockable skits? Is there like a feature in the game where you can go back like and like redo a thing, or do you have to do a new playthrough, like a new game plus?
No, it's like they're like segmented off. They're like okay. In the bonus menu.
Got it. Okay. But yeah, I mean, other than that, you know, what platform did you play it on, and how was the performance on that?
Switch 1, I played it obviously on a Switch 2. Visually didn't look great. It's fine in handheld mode. It's like 720p. The upscaling's fine for the 3D elements. It doesn't look great for the text, especially if you're docked. It's not great. But
is there a Switch 2 version of this?
There is, but they did not send out code for the Switch 2 version until, like Mikhail said, like close to the embargo.
I have played all three versions of it, though,
and it doesn't do the Zelda scenario of like if you have a Switch 1 copy, it doesn't like play the Switch 2 version of it or whatever the fuck.
No, they're completely different games with no save data transferring between them. They're treated like the Raidu remastered, where it just shows up as two icons. Like, if you have both versions, obviously no one is going to buy both versions, but since I was covering all three, I had both of them. And yeah, they just show up with the same icon and the same name, and the only way you can tell them apart before launching the game is if you press plus on the controller and then it says Nintendo Switch 2 software or Nintendo Switch software. Otherwise, it's exactly the same on the dashboard. And it's kind of a baffling release because I played like I said before, the Switch 2 code came in very close to embargo, so I had only like a day and a half with it, and I immediately could tell it like looks much nicer, probably 1080p, but I didn't pixel count. I put up comparisons and all on the site in the article, but the one problem is like James played the Switch 1 version on Switch 2. Now that gives you 60 fps. The problem with the Switch 2 version is you don't get 60 FPS because of the higher resolution. And it's not optimized, or they couldn't get it to hit 60 FPS consistently. So it's just not smooth enough. It looks better though. There's a quality and performance setting when you play docked for some reason. I didn't expect that in a game like this. Neither of those is 60 FPS locked again. The mouse controls are also pretty bad, to be honest. It's like, when you swap to mouse controls, it changes the button prompts to look like a mouse cursor, like with actual PC mouse button prompts, not what you'd expect from a Switch 2 game with mouse controls, like, say, Nobunaga's Ambition Awakening. So it feels like the mouse controls are pretty tacked on. It does have touchscreen support, though, which is nice, but honestly, the Switch 2 version is disappointing, like, regardless of the fact that it ships on a key card for people who care about that. And I would say if someone has the ability to play it on PC, like Steam Deck, you get 90 FPS at like native resolution and you don't have to worry about anything. And you can even like use the trackpad to get precision aiming and stuff like that for the cursor. So it's just a mediocre Switch 2 version, I'd say. And yeah, if someone wants 60 FPS on Switch 2, you have to play the Switch 1 version, sadly, which means looks pretty bad, docked, looks okay handheld. So yeah, I put up a big comparison.
We're running into like similar scenarios, like of how like some games, PS4 version games run better on PS5. But
I actually thought of Elden Ring initially, because I was like, Elden Ring, you play with cutback visuals, but you get like almost a locked 60 FPS. But over here, it's like, I don't know what to say about that, because if you play the Switch 1 version, it even loads faster than the Switch 2 version on a Switch 2, which is kind of funny. But yeah, I made sure to retest that 3 times because I was like, how is the Switch 1 version loading faster than the native Switch 2 version? But yeah, it is a bit faster. So yeah, it's a bizarre release. Not having save data transfer is something I will never stop being annoyed about. Even like Sega did that with Shadow Generations and Sonic Generations. But just it's unfortunate that the transition period from Switch 1 to Switch 2 still has this stuff happening. So yeah.
Yeah, that's it's It feels like it's, in some aspects it's rougher than like past generations with other platform holders, like from PS4 to PS5 and Xbox One to Xbox Series X. That feels like the one for Nintendo, just it has a lot of like muck.
I wonder how much of it is like Nintendo just being purposefully like super, super like restrictive.
Yeah,
pre-release. Because mm-hmm. I do know, speaking to some developers, that has maybe been a problem. And like, obviously, like when I did that preview thing for the Sega Switch 2 stuff, they had to have like Nintendo staff in a room. Like that was mandated by Nintendo, and that was just like a few weeks before the system came out. So I don't know, maybe.
Yeah.
But
hopefully within 6 months, you know, a lot of the stuff is more ironed out. One would hope, but
yeah,
we can really say.
And as someone who's not familiar with this series, when I was reading Colin's review, and I had seen some, you know, just reception to the game online, you know, Twitter, Blue Sky forums, things like that. Just the idea of where it's like, it doesn't progress the story, therefore it's pointless. It's like, I don't think that's necessarily true, like, by axiom. But when also on top of that, it doesn't like live up to the gameplay, like the fact that it's completely linear, the fact that the characters, they like, okay, maybe it's an opportunity for the characters to be like developed further. It's like, no, they're kind of flanderized. And like, it's sort of the thing where just because it's an air quote doesn't mean it was doomed from the start, but it doesn't pick up the slack in any other area. It seems to be kind of the way that I'm interpreting both Cullen's review and James's kind of podcast review here on the site.
You know what this reminds me of? I'm going to pull a Brian. You know what this reminds me of?
Okay.
What's that? It reminds me of Siege of Dragonspear.
Yep. So that is an integral Baldur's Gate campaign made by a different developer 10 years or 15 years after the fact.
But the similarity is obviously it's an integral that, like, okay, can't really progress anything. It changes things up, but they're not really very good. The characters are kind of weird. It's just kind of like, do you play it if you're playing the games in order, like chronologically? Yeah, it's a weird interquel.
So. I love how that's described as pulling a Brian. I'm like, what does he mean? And then when he went that route, I'm like, that's an interesting way, angle
I,
to get.
I haven't played this I game, love that. But I'm going to tether it to some completely
I
different
love that.
Game.
No, I mean, yeah, to be specific, I mean, Brian's like, this reminds me of this other game that sort of doesn't relate, but kind of does.
That's great, though.
Anyway. Mikhail basically already spoke to it, but Mikhail did put up his usual feature for comparing it on Steam Deck, Switch 2. He kind of already spoke to it here in terms of frame rate, load times, those sorts of things, but it is up on the site as well.
Yeah, thank you both, Mikhail, James, and Colin, just investigating that game because, you know, a lot of people were very excited when it was first announced. And, you know, just I think it's, as a lot of people have said surrounding that game, it's like, it's, you know, manage your expectations. Don't go in thinking it's the next third mainline big AI Somnium.
Mm-hmm. And that is admittedly kind of the one release we had for RPGs. I guess I will say one more thing. I'll go slightly out of order here. One more article shout out is that we did also have the release of Neverwinter Nights 2 Enhanced Edition. This was announced, I think, at the Xbox Summer event. It's basically re-releasing Neverwinter Nights 2, the developer of the re-releases, Aspyr Games. And we had Scott review this for us. There was already a complete edition on Neverwinter Nights 2 available on GOG. This is supposed to be an enhanced edition. And Scott, actually, on his review, we didn't get him on the podcast here, but he did actually a really thorough job booting up the complete edition, the GOG version, and then booting up the enhanced edition, new version, and really like directly comparing them. And basically, the enhanced edition falls short in a lot of ways, has a lot of weird bugs. There's a lot of ways where the complete edition performs better. And things like missing sound effects when he was in the menu of Neverwinter Nights 2, like character creator, like the voice selection was off by one. Like it'd say like voice one, voice two, but like the voice that would play would not be the voice selected. Or like it's weird issues with the game there. And also talking about just how the camera doesn't work at the high resolutions the way it's supposed to without like really fiddling with it.
There's also something about like when you're moving, like depending on how you're moving, sometimes it just doesn't let you turn.
Really?
Yeah. Weird. I've seen a lot of people. I think Josh posted a few things. There's just a lot of like small little like bugs and glitches that like maybe not individually are any of them game breaking. It's just like death by a thousand cuts. Like, why are all these small issues here now when they weren't there before? Scott's review is like, it's great that this is finally on consoles because it was never on consoles before. And the controller support is pretty good for what it is. So like, as a re-release that gets this game to be more available to more people, I can applaud it, you know, at least a little bit. But it seems like a lot of other things really need to be tuned up or tidied up a bit. Like, if you're a PC player, it's a hard decision, or it's, you know, maybe not as clear-cut. Like, maybe you should just not get the enhanced version. Maybe you should just get the GOG version, the original version. So.
Yeah, so it's funny that both Scott and I approached this from, like, completely different angles, because when... So this game has cross-platform multiplayer now, which obviously the original was just on PC, so you could only... I don't even know if that had online... I guess it did have online multiplayer, but I don't know. It has cross-platform multiplayer now. So when I was testing that with Scott, I just realized that for him, this is... Like, he's comparing it. He did a fantastic job comparing it to the GOG version, and he was talking to me about how they've changed some stuff and some stuff is missing and all that. And from my point of view, I've never played Neverwinter Nights 2 before. It was never available on Steam, and I kept waiting for a discount on GOG, which never happened, so I just didn't end up buying it. So for me, this was playing it on like Switch and playing it on Steam Deck was the first time I've ever played this game. And I was happy with the controller support. I was happy with how it was running and stuff like that. And I was just talking to him, and I definitely got to that conclusion that for people who already have it on PC, and if they don't care about controller support or the cross-platform online, you're not really getting much by buying the game again, at least right now. But from my point of view, I wanted it on Steam Deck with controller support. There was no controller support on GOG. So this gave me that. It runs fantastic on Steam Deck. And I was like, yep, works online, multiplayer works good. So I was like, fine with that. And when it released, I was talking to a few friends who, like, some have played it before, some have not played it before. And it's the same conclusion that Scott came to in the end, that if you have it on GOG, you're not getting much by buying it for like $30 right now on Steam, or like buying or upgrading to the enhanced edition on GOG because they had this discount loyalty thing. But if you only play on console, it's good. And this is one of those, like, you know, the transition period between one console to another. Neverwinter Nights 2 on Switch 1 does not feel good at all to me. But when you play the Switch 1 version on Switch 2, you're getting like 60 FPS and it loads faster. And also, I don't know if this is one of those situations where they didn't have a dev kit for Switch 2 and they knew a lot of people would maybe play it over there, so they just left the frame rate uncapped. But this is one of those releases where I can only recommend it if you're playing it via backward compatibility on Switch 2, not on Switch 1. So yeah, it controls well. I was happy with the controller UI and stuff like that, so... It's a very interesting release for people who've played it before and for people who haven't played it before. That's what I'll leave this at.
I haven't played this, but I've played a lot of Obsidian games. This game is originally Obsidian. I've never played this. I think I probably mentioned this in the last podcast, but I never played the original either. So it's like, eventually, deep on the backlog, I'll get to these games.
No, I'm exactly at the same point. I was like, I need to play the original, then this version, and then... another person, I forget who, Dave in chat or in staff chat was like, you don't need to play the first one. They're pretty standalone. I'm like, but you don't understand. I got to, like, I'm compelled to play the first one before this one. So eventually I'll do that. But yeah, unfortunately it just feels like they fell short. And like, is this the definitive version of the game? It's like, in some respects, yes. In many respects, no. It's just another more convenient version. Obviously for console, it's the version you got. For controller support, it's the one that supports it, you know, out of the box. But in terms of being definitive, maybe falls a little bit short. And that, I think, covers us for like the RPG releases of the week. But we have a few other video game releases this week. And we're at a point of the year where I mentioned this on the last podcast. I'm not going to slow roll this. I said I completely forgot that Donkey Kong Bonanza was coming out in the summer and wasn't a holiday game. So I was like, I had no idea that's coming out. Well, it came out and we figured... For this month, we can talk about it. People have been playing it. We put it on the podcast doc. A little bit of extra credit outside of our normal wheelhouse, but we figured we have an opportunity to talk about it. So we will, at least to a small extent. I know that a few people on stage have been talking, have been playing this game and working their way through it. Josh, I'll start out with you, and then if others want to chime in later. But I know you specifically wanted to cover this for... There you go. So we'll have Josh and James at least speak to Donkey Kong Bonanza, starting out with Josh. And we do realize this is kind of a side quest, so to speak, but we'll indulge it.
Yeah, it's not like a full-blown RPG. I mean, but you know, there are small things like, hey, like the bananas that you're collecting in the game, you know, when you get a certain amount of them, you get a skill point, you know, you can upgrade, like, you know, your max health, you know, and you can gain the ability to do
that. That's an RPG. We should review
it. There you go. But, you know,
you also small... got, like, gear that you can, upgrade that also has, like, skills attached to it.
Yeah, like they're just RPG light stuff. Like I got Trunks last night that like, hey, you can increases your swimming speed by 10% if you wear this. Like, oh, it's fine.
Upgrade them and it'll make it so you can increase your swimming speed even more.
Yeah, so this is a brand new 3D platformer from the Super Mario Odyssey development team down at over at Nintendo. First full-fledged like new Donkey Kong game like that's not a re-release like since what like Tropical Freeze I think on
yeah in over a decade
yeah it's been a long time and Tropical Freeze was one hell of a game but so I'm still fairly early on in it I haven't had much time to play it as much as I wanted to but I booted it up last night and I got that moment where I'm like oh no I'm old as fuck. I played it about half an hour, and then I had to stop because I got motion sick because I didn't turn off the camera shake. I thought I'd be fine. I could handle it. I'm like, I'm still young. I can play video games just fine in their default settings, aside from like swapping the A and B functions. I can do this. No, after half an hour, I had to like recover and take a break. I was like, oh, I feel kind of queasy because of the camera shake. So I had to turn that off. And then play a little bit more of it after it was off, and I felt better. Not to say that turning it off completely is like remedied like all of my problems. Like there's still some spots where the camera can kind of get fucked up because like this game has a lot of terraforming in it. Of course, when people think about terraforming in games, think about like the Red Faction series. So like when there's like different, a lot of different materials like you know soil, grass. Rocky formations that like you can just kind of like punch your way through or like get a terrain from the ground and like and a slab from the ground and like swing and then terraform the environment around you. Like the only things that I really stop you are like these metal skeletons that you can't get through. But there's a lot of like if you wanted to, you could like make like a whole like just tunnels in that game constantly with the amount of terraforming that you can do. So, like, the camera does its best with trying to, like, keep up with you. But, like, let's say like early on in the game when they're teaching you everything, you're kind of at this sort of, like, underground cavern environment. And there's a lot of, like, close-ups of you terraforming through the environment, like, almost in total darkness to find your way forward. And the camera, you know, you can still sort of see stuff, but you do have, like, this claustrophobic... point of view because it's kind of zoomed in up close as you're trying to like you know find your way forward through this tunnel system to move forward and that could fuck with you like you know if you're not have some you know resistance to that and you know that it for people like me you know who are trying to wrestle with their mortality going forward you know I have to play it in chunks I guess. Instead of trying to play it for a lot of hours at a time, I'm like, okay, I gotta give my mind a break, and I'll get back to it later. So it's just one of those things. It's like, man, I'm getting old. Fuck. So, but I'm still fairly early on. I think it's a really, really fun and interesting game. I do like the after like the tutorial section, you're like in a much more brighter, open zone, and it's just a lot of like. Fun. It's very vibrant and it's very responsive to your controls. I love all the animations that DK is able to do. It like just punch very fast downward, forward, upward. I also like that he has like a hand slam that you can do that like auto pick up all the collectibles around you, so you don't have to like go around and like pick up like coins or anything. Like you just like slam on the ground and then it'll auto collect it to you. So I've only played just a little bit right now. But I can't wait to play more. It's kind of like my first impressions and just wanted to vent that getting old is real. James,
I feel that like with first person games with like head bob and things like that. Mm-hmm. So like, yeah. I do feel that where it's like this used to never even think about this, and now I think about it. But yeah. James, you put in some decent time into Bonanza. You mentioned you're in the post game, so like obviously we got some initial impressions and some very specific, you know, discussion from Josh. But what about your time with Bonanza?
So we talked about like kind of jokingly how there's like some like RPG light elements in it with the skill points and obviously the gear. Both of those things have basically fixed my main problem with Odyssey, which I felt that Odyssey was, for lack of a better term, too streamlined. And it felt like the way that the moons worked, there wasn't really enough of a reason to like go for each of the moons. Because it's like once you got enough moons for like the progressors, like very little reason to do so besides like completionist sake. And it also felt kind of, for lack of a better term, it just wasn't interesting going for the moons for me in Odyssey. Whereas because of the skill points and because of like going for the fossils to buy gear in Donkey Kong, it actually makes me want to complete the game because there's like a tangible reason to do so. Odyssey, I barely touched the post game. I did the bare minimum to get to the final level, but I'm like licking the plate clean in Donkey Kong, and this is probably my favorite 3D platformer I've played in a very long time.
There's a lot of like, even just like early on, there's like a lot of really, really cool like segments. Like I started like messing like with the bomb material. So like there's like a segment early on where like you're like have this rematerializing, respawning bomb block that like you take a chunk out of, and then you're flinging it to like nearby terrain because that's like pretty efficient to like terraform them to find hidden treasure chests in that terrain. And then so once you open up that treasure chest via bomb from a distance, I'm like, okay, I got a map that shows like the location of like a nearby like fossil. And the fossil is used for currency to like buy like, you know, stuff from the like cosmetic shops that that can give you like, you know, things like increase swimming speed by like 10%. And it became sort of like almost a mini game of sorts where like I was getting the locations of like these nearby fossils, and I'm like, okay, I'm gonna keep on taking out this like bomb slabs and like try to snipe my throws towards the terrain of where those fossils are. And like even from a distance, it all like works like well, like, you know, like I felt like there's like really no limitations like how far I can throw this thing. It won't like disappear midair or anything like that. It's like even to some far off terrain, I'm just like kind of sniping my throws towards them, so I don't have to like manually move myself there, because I found it more efficient to just like throw bomb slabs at terrain to get the items and then continue terraforming the thing that I was already doing in front of me to get more treasure chests that shows the locations of more nearby fossils. So it was kind of like, for like a good like maybe 5 to 10 minute segment, I was just there kind of just like entranced by this whole just like small section of the map of like, yeah, I really want to make use of all these bomb slabs to fuck all the terrain up nearby me to get these fossils. It was like such a weird like small thing. I'm like, this is awesome. This is really awesome.
Mikhail, did you have a comment?
Yeah, just to go back a bit to what Josh said about the camera shake thing, and to actually touch on what James said. So, like, just for some backstory, Super Mario Odyssey is my favorite platformer, 3D platformer of all time. I've tried many since then and dropped them. I tried Galaxy through the 3D All-Stars collection and got sick of the motion control, so just dropped it. I actually couldn't finish Astro Bot because the camera movement was giving me motion sickness, and the game doesn't have any settings. Like, it has this auto follow camera thing which I just couldn't disable completely, and the movement speed was just getting to me, so I had to like play it in half an hour sections, and I just said maybe I'll wait for a patch. Never went back to it. When I played Mario Kart World, not a platformer, obviously, I was like, what is up with Nintendo and not letting me adjust the camera speed in these games? Like, it's a racing game. Let me just adjust that. But no. So when I started playing Donkey Kong, and I was like, oh, I need to adjust the camera shake. And I was like, wait, this is a Nintendo game. I'm not going to be able to do that. But you can. So I switched that off. And I actually saw camera speed options and I put it to the maximum speed. And I was like, okay, this feels good now. Everything feels good. The HD rumble feels good. Game feels nice. And yeah, my Donkey Kong experience is like I've played all the games available on Switch through Nintendo Switch Online and whatever's natively released. Tropical Freeze is the only one I really, really love. This has the potential to like match that or exceed that so far. I've played like an hour and a half, I think. That's like not even probably 10% of what the game has to offer, but I'm enjoying the, like, you can just break shit. Like, it's like Limp Bizkit game or something like that. That's what I've been calling it in Discord so far. It's like the Limp Bizkit break stuff game or something. So I'm enjoying that. I've heard the game opens up a lot later on. Hopefully I'll be done with it by the next time we record, or maybe two podcasts from now or something, but very happy with it so far. I was expecting to, I've been burned by so many 3D platformers over the years. I think the only one I've enjoyed besides Odyssey is Penny's Big Breakaway, which I don't know how many people here have played.
I've played it.
Yeah, so I feel like that's like a 3D platformer for sickos, and I love that. So let's see how this one ends up, but it potentially can be in my top three. So I'm excited to get back to it. I'm probably going to play it tomorrow, like for most of tomorrow. So we'll see how that goes. But yeah, I'm just very happy that they have a camera shake option and camera speed options, which I didn't expect in a Nintendo game.
Yeah, congrats to Switch 2 for getting another game on it since its launch.
Hey, it's getting Wild Hearts soon. Game of the year.
Great. Great.
Did you have any other comments on our little side quest over to Donkey Kong Bonanza, which just released on the Switch 2 this week?
Like, I'm still very early on, so nothing substantial right now, but I'm looking forward to playing
that. That finale is probably the craziest in any Nintendo game.
Ah, man, I haven't heard
like
that
more
yet,
than Tales of the Kingdom.
Sorry, I was going to say, I did read Alex Donaldson's, who is our boss, but also is an editor at large over at Eurogamer now, and he reviewed this, so I did read his review about it, about Donkey Kong Bonanza, and he kind of had similar thoughts about how by the time he got to the finale, he thought it was like the sort of game got, he was really impressed. He thought like emotionally it kind of like crescendoed at that point. Might have been one of the best like platformer finales he's played in a long time. So I read his review over in Eurogamer for that. And I've never played Odyssey. I was like, you know what? I'll get around to it eventually, that I never have. I used to like play the Mario RPG, not Mario RPGs, the Mario platformers religiously, but I never got around to Odyssey. And I don't think I will, at least not in the short term. But it's cool to see the Bonanza. I don't know, it's cool just to see like a premium Donkey Kong game again. He was kind of like, you know, forgotten and B-tiered for a bit, or like kind of outsourced to, you know, Retro Studios or other things, and still had like, you know, Tropical Freeze was well received critically. But just to see like Nintendo, what do they call their studios? You know, EPD1, like one of their main teams tackle Donkey Kong. It's just cool to see, rather than saying, here's a Mario platformer for Switch 2, because that was kind of what everyone expected, but like, nope, Donkey Kong. And to see it received as well as it has, I think is just really cool.
Yeah, it's been kind of interesting of seeing Nintendo kind of, I guess, evolve that character, starting with like the recent Mario movie, and like it getting a redesign and kind of being more, there's a lot more Donkey Kong in that movie that like you would expect when you watch it. So and then them sticking with that design, and like, here it's like, here's a just front and center one of the launch window titles for our new system, and kind of leading that charge. It's like it's a new Mario platform. It's like, no, it's a new Donkey Kong. All right, yeah. Shit, why not?
I'll just say one thing for Brian. Whenever you do get around to Odyssey, if you can play it on a Switch 2, the upgrade is massive.
All right, first step one, acquire a Switch 2.
Yep. I mean, buying a new console for old games is kind of the MO for all consoles right now, unfortunately.
I don't know. Yes, Canada, I can find Switch 2s just by walking in the store. They're so easy to find.
I have GameStop credit, so that's what I want to do, is just walk into a GameStop and get it. I try not to keep a backlog because they kind of stress me out. Like, oh, I will never get around to this. But like, if I had a backlog for Nintendo games, I've never played Metroid Dread, and I've never played Odyssey. So like, I would probably, if I ever were to tackle those, tackle them back to back, on a Switch 2, ideally. We have one other game to talk about before we go into a little light of a news segment here. And this is a game that I hadn't heard about until about an hour ago when Chao said, you know what, maybe I can talk about this. Again, it's a little bit of a side quest, so to speak, not explicitly an RPG, but we have an opportunity here to talk about it. So we figured out we might as well. It looks like this game released on Steam back in May of this year. So pretty contemporary in that sense. The game is titled Nitro Express, and the Steam description of it is, Nitro Express is a 2D side view gun action game where cute pixel art girls shoot assault weapons free aiming in the streets of Japan. So I've heard this described as a shmup or a beat 'em up or shoot 'em up. Like, so Chao, I guess you picked this up. Did you pick it up on Steam or on a console? I don't know much about this.
I think there's a console version. So it's on Steam, so.
All right.
Oh, so I just picked it up.
Nitro Express and all what it is.
So Nitro Express is, I think it was showed in like this indie game fest or something that James went to. Was it PAX?
It was PAX West. I got to preview it. And I wrote a little something during like my PAX West write up for that year. I really enjoyed that little I played of it. But since then, I just haven't been able to get around this game. But I've seen I've seen my friends play it. And saw a good chunk of what this game has, and it's really really cool how the full game is shaped up.
Yeah, it's a little bit short, I would say. You could probably beat it in 2 hours, so I think it's kind of justified with the small price tag because the game's not really long. How do I describe this game? I think the best way to describe it, if you ever seen the anime Pat Labor or whatever, it's like cops with Gundams, if you've ever seen that, but they're not, it's not like a war story, it's more like a slice of life kind of thing, if you've ever seen that anime. It's very old. But in this thing, it has like a similar theme. So basically, you're playing as a new hire cop, and then on her first day in the job, it's like people are hacking these machines, and then she's gonna go out and just stop it, right? And as soon as your mission starts, you basically have like a limited amount of funds, and you can use the funds to buy your main arm or your like secondary arm. So your character has two weapons that they carry, and then they go on to the mission, right? So your mission performance is kind of like determines how much money you get in the mission, and that money is used to buy like more guns for your mission. So that's kind of like the gameplay loop of the game, right? I think one of the things that's a little bit hard to get used to is the controls in this game. The controls are very... How do I say it? It feels like you're playing Metroid controls on a Metal Slug game, if that's
the
way to
describe
it. It's
definitely designed for mouse and keyboard over controller, because it is one of those you use your WASD to move around and your mouse cursor to aim to the left and right and above you and all sorts, but but that gets wonky if you're trying to use a right analog stick to control the arc of your shots.
Oh, I was playing on controller this whole time, so yeah. I didn't know what like keyboard controls would be like.
But, mouse and it's definitely more in line for mouse and keyboard. Not to say that controller's impossible to play it with, but it's deliberately designed for mouse and keyboard.
Okay. Maybe I should give it a mouse and keyboard try next time.
Yeah.
But yeah, like the whole game, you know, if I felt like I'm playing Metroid controls on a Metal Slug game, right? Like, mm-hmm. Metal Slug game controls are very, very simple and very easy, right? But this takes a bit to get used to, right? And I think when you're using like a controller, I think like you had to press the right analog stick or something to do the melee attack. There's a melee attack.
Yeah, that's wonky. Yeah.
So I don't know. I think the controls are probably like the hardest thing to get used to. But this game is like extremely charming. So if you like the retro like 2D art, and even this like, you know, just the theme of it, I think it's just like a whole parody spin on like futuristic Tokyo, which is, I haven't seen this trope in a long time, right? It's something I actually like.
It's very parody filled of like making fun of like other games, like in a wink nod sort of things. Like there's like a section in the game where like, hey, you're trying to sneak by these cameras using a cardboard box. this, like little small segments like that. And And the nice thing about this game is like there's a lot of variety because there's a lot of like different guns and the way that they their properties, like some have different like, you know, reload times, but to compensate for that they have like long magazines and the way that like, if the more you use it the more you can upgrade it, sort of deal. You have like, but it's not just standard guns. You have like stuff like rocket launchers, for example, that you can use that are like obviously not great for mobs, they're great for bosses. And sort of, and you know, bosses have like weak points that you deliberately want to aim for to do more damage to them. And it's just it's definitely a game that like, even though the runtime is short, you can tell that like, it was made with a lot of love because it's a fairly relatively small indie studio that made it. But it's like a, it's always cool to see the you know, developers like make the sort of game because it's like, you don't get a lot of these kinds of games in this style, and I love that like, you know, there's a score as well. Always loved like some good old arcade action in that regard.
You get
the Kodak calls as well, right? Yeah, like,
I love the Kodak calls. Kodak calls were hilarious. Like I think like one of the things that make me kind of fall in love with the game is just like right in the beginning, where there's like a flying drone carrying food, and you shot it down, and you just eat the food to get your health back, and the lady immediately calls you. Did you just shot down like a food delivery drone? And are you eating from it?
Yeah.
So it's like one of those kind of things. Those, I think that's kind of like what makes me fall in love with the game. Just like those, kind of like the comedy aspect of it, right?
Yeah. The one thing that like, you know, that it's gonna be a hit or miss for some people. It's like this game deliberately has a 30 FPS cap. I don't think there's any plans to officially support a 60 FPS.
Yeah, people are still whining about it, and I think the biggest people that whine about is having achievements on there. I don't know. I think people just love to flex about achievements, which is kind of sad, but I feel like that's the world has come to, because
it doesn't have achievements. Is that the thing?
The game does not have achievements implemented in this game yet.
And so. People are like, why not? Okay, I get
so, it. Yeah, people are more upset that the game has no achievements than the performance of the game, which I think is a sad thing.
I think there's like a fan mod that like ups the 60 FPS cap, but it messes with some of the AI behavior and patterns in that game, the hitboxes and stuff like that, because this game, it seems like it was deliberately made with the 30 FPS cap in mind, and trying to mess with that cap, you know, will break some stuff about it in that regard. So, you know, it's a take it or leave it type of thing. It's kind of, we've talked about it sometimes on this podcast, but it's like, it's kind of, you kind of have to get into that philosophy, especially for shmups, for example, that like have deliberate frame drops during some bullet heavy sequences, because if you didn't have those deliberate frame rate drops, then you wouldn't be able to dodge like the incoming barrage of like bullets coming at you, because they're running at normal speed, unlike the deliberate frame rate drops, which slows down their speed.
That's my favorite complaint when I'm playing a cave shut 'em up. It was like, I think it was like the Mishihime Sama, like Vitari. I think people were like, I think they have like a release on Xbox or even Steam, like the first game on Steam. And then, you know, when you like have like a million bullets, the game intentionally slows down so that you could dodge it, and people keep complaining. It's like, is this a hardware issue? It's like, why isn't it running on 60 FPS? It's like,
yeah.
Why would you want 60 FPS when there's a billion bullets at your face? The game's intentionally slowing it down so that you could dodge it, right? So I think after complaints, I think like in later versions of the game, they implemented like a feature where no hardware slowdown or something, or something like that. And it's just like, these idiots they don't know what they're asking for, right?
But that's what modern media, you know, is teaching them. It's like, hey, this is always good. You should never accept anything less. And like, and then there's a different like philosophy back then of like using drops and hardware performance as a design philosophy, like that's integrated into your game design, which is a really interesting thing to like consider back then, because of hardware limitations that you could deliberately design around. Like, you know, like the specs of a PS1 and PS2 are always going to be set. There's no way to scale them up and down. That is the game that you are the specs that you are developing for, and you're not anticipating scalability, because at the time that's what you were developing only for, and you had consistent performance because you knew that people who bought these machines had those specs. you know? So it's a weird thing when you think about it, like, from the modern lens of, like, no, everything has to be scalable now. And
yeah, I know, people always want 60 FPS things, but they just don't know how to use, like, having, like, a dip in performance to your gameplay advantage.
I get it. Yeah, it's difficult to kind of at least teach people about that and say, hey, you know, things were different back then. But yeah, it's cool. You know, I'm glad that you're able to check out Nitro Express. I hopefully have time to get around to it whenever.
Yeah, it's not.
There's
real
like a million game. There's like a million cool playism games that are like coming out. Like, you know, the Outrider Mako was another one that recently released like back in June that I got the preview at PAX West, and that was cool. I know there was another one. Metalbringer was also one that I saw several of my friends play and had a great time with. That, like, I want to get to seven that time too. Good on Playism, you know, for just supporting these and publishing these releases from like much, much smaller developers. Most of them are like based in Japan as well. So giving them an easier way to sell their games on Steam and giving them, you know, the marketing and the coverage, you know, to have presence like in conventions like PAX West and ongoing now like Bit Summit as well.
Was there other games that you remember from there? I think when you bring up that game, I was thinking like Samurai Bringers or something like that.
There's one, Homura Hime was one I got to try out as well, and that's gonna be out sometime this year. I don't know if they've announced a release date for it yet. Million Depth was also one that I also really liked as well when I got to check out their games that one year. They had like 6 to 7 different games there. Yeah. But if you look at their Steam like publisher page, you just like check upcoming, it's like way more than that. Like, they have like a bunch of things coming out. You know, never stops. Hopefully they're at PAX West again this year. I'd love to visit again, them again this year and see what else they have in store.
Yeah, it's quite the catalog. Maybe I'll take a look at see what other things there.
Yeah,
I mean, yeah, it's even like, I mean, getting mixed up like games I see from back then, like that World of War game that you guys were playing a couple years ago, I think it was. It's been 2 years already.
Yeah. What was that Playism published game that had the blue and yellow color palette that was like a adventure type game, I think? Like a what's it called?
I know they did Blade Chimera earlier
no,
this
no, no.
year.
It wasn't like an action.
Oh, is it like the Viet adventure sort of thing? It's like Eden Schemata or something.
No, not that. It was it was one that I know was like super, super beloved in Japan, but I haven't really seen too many people talk about it outside of Japan, even though they did handle localization.
I don't remember off the top of my head. That's a good question though.
Let me check.
Was it Phantom Rose?
I'm just checking through.
No, it's something else. I know what James is talking about, but I forgot the name.
I don't know off the top of my head.
I have it on my wish list, but my wish list has like 200 games now.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, you know, go check out Playism's like Steam publisher page, man. They have a fuck ton of games. Then, you know, I think there's secretly something for everyone, but like it's just you have to know which one you're looking for. Like they published Nausea originally as well on Steam.
Yeah, that gets an anime pretty soon. Maybe I'll finally check out the anime instead of reading for
the
video.
Go play the fucking game, Chow. It's awesome.
All right, fine, I will.
It's incredible. I love it so much. But I hope the anime does it justice. I'm very, very much looking for it.
And that covers us, I think, for all of the different, you know, RPG or non-RPG games we wanted to talk about this week before going into news. We did have one other feature on the site, and James, you'll have to remind me exactly where this is teed up from. Obviously, anime back in... Okay, there's an anime extra. We've been talking about Fuga Melodies of Steel 3 released recently. We've talked about that. You put up a feature on the site specifically talking about, not Fuga, but about CyberConnect 2 on the studio's 30th anniversary. So you wrote up a feature called On the Eve of the 30th Anniversary, CyberConnect 2 Looks Firmly Towards the Future. Obviously, Fuga, the trilogy, is, you know, in the books. Can you just tee us up to, like, what you were able to... I'm not sure if you got to talk to them at Anime Expo or where this is coming from.
Yeah, so pretty much every Anime Expo I've had the chance to talk with Miyazaki Song, the vice president, like pretty much as far back as 2019. Obviously, 2020, 2021 didn't happen, but every other year it pretty much has been the case where they go to Anime Expo, I talk with them, get, I guess, a yearly update. This year, it was a bit interesting because, like, Fuga's done with, so I was curious, like, what's exactly next? And honestly, I asked the question that I should have asked, like, a couple years ago. It's like, man, every year, without, like, fail, like, you guys have a panel that's basically a protracted, hey, work for us in Japan. And I was, and I just had to ask, it's like, so what's the specific reason for this? It's like, because it's clearly something that the company holds like at a super high level of importance, otherwise they wouldn't keep doing it year after year after year consistently. And like the Fuga 1 and 2 director was like French, came from France, now he's working in Japan at like Platinum still, last I heard. But it's like, it's just one of those things where I realized, huh, might actually want to get some more information about that. And I think there's some interesting responses there too. But long story short, from their perspective, since their titles sell best outside of Japan, especially in the US, it only makes sense to like recruit from that player base because they're going to have a better idea of what those markets would be interested in. So neat stuff.
A little bit like down of a downer in some ways. I'm reading through your little preview here. Like Japan has a declining population, so that means our potential workforce is decreasing over time. So, who else better than to look overseas at, you know, our U.S. fan base to come work for us?
I mean, it is depressing in a sense, but it's also like pragmatic. It makes sense.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
I think it's very telling that. That they were both so forthright about that, like, and so like blunt about it, and it, the way he said it wasn't meant to be depressing. It's more just like a matter of fact. It's like, we're not dumb. Like, we've been our company's almost 30 years old. We can't and like read between the lines. They don't have enough people in Japan potentially in the next 30 years to keep a steady. Talent flow. It's like it is depressing, but it makes sense. And it's like, man, that's very forward thinking. That's actually kind of neat to just hear them outright say that.
Yeah, this shows that they're really in it for the long term. Like, they are looking not just ahead, but ahead of ahead in that sense.
Yep.
Yeah, you see more and more of these stories come out of Japanese companies and developers, especially in their gaming industry. Like, we were talking about Donkey Kong Bonanza, for example. Like, much of that project is Nintendo training up the next generation developers for them. And you know,
yeah, the director of Donkey Kong Bonanza, want to know what his probably next most well known project was?
What was it? I think I read this and I forgot what
Final
it was.
Final Fantasy 15 Comrades.
Hell yeah. Damn. That's right. Yeah. So, and then, you know, several weeks ago, we talked about Elden Ring Nightreign and the, you know, the creative director of that was like the battle designer or director of Elden Ring, the base game Elden Ring. So him getting the directorial role through Nightreign, getting their feet wet.
It's not quite the same thing, but my next and last interview from, well, not last, but my next interview from, like, not from Anime Expo, but around then, which is the embargo lifts next week, we'll be able to talk about it next week. It's kind of like a similar vein. It's been a bit of a trend. It's fascinating to see, like, stuff like this happen all at once.
Yeah, it's kind of like a... almost like a bummer here in the West because, like, you know, you hear about like the mass layoffs consistently here, like in the Western space, and while, you know, while a lot of the Asian territories are thinking are forward thinking about trying to, you know, provide the tools from like legacy training from like veterans to the next generation developers, trying to pass on that talent, trying to, you know, make sure that the future is secure with, you know, when people inevitably have to retire from the industry in that regard. So, you know, it's a little bit depressing that, like, man, I wish that, like, you know, the Western sphere kind of had that mentality and just industry-wide, like, you know, had sort of like legislation and policies that would reinforce this motion, unlike what we have now.
Yeah.
I was trying to think, like, how best to respond to that other than, like, just nod my head because, you know, oh no, we got to make our number go up this year, so we're going to shortchange our future by laying off 1,000 people or more, as we've seen worth, over the last 2 years.
Mentioning that the last three, like, Heelys Game of the Year winners have been Elden Ring, Baldur's Gate 3, and Astrobot. All examples of teams that have been working, like, honing their craft for decades.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
And that's not a coincidence. You let teams stick together, and even if they're not, like, even if, like, people and teams learn and grow from working together. They know what didn't work and what did, and no shit, games are gonna just trend to being better if you let people, like...
You can't be afraid to let a team make a mistake, you know? Like, if they have, like, a release and it didn't do as well as you hoped for, that doesn't mean you should disband them and and dissolve them and try to... Do it again, but like another team that's kind of, like, you just slept on together. It's like, no, teams grow together through thick and thin. You know, they have their ups, they have their downs, but they benefit overall by sticking together as much as possible. And that's kind of like the natural way of things.
We might not see the outcome of this yet, but like Omega Force, you know, Wolong was reportedly like a good number of junior developers. And even though that game might have not set the world on fire, those, you know, those developers got some real experience, you know, launching a new title. And even though we don't see the outcome quite yet, is that going to pay dividends in times when it comes for Neo 3 to release and have those developers have that experience on them? It's like, I believe so. Obviously we'll report back once it sees that, but just saying, oh, it didn't hit our targets, cut them all. It's just so short-sighted and it's so unfortunate. So for that, we'll go into our news. We don't have a lot of main topics here, but we have a handful of things. Nothing, no big announcements in this window. This window has been a little bit quiet, but we do have a few things here. We'll actually start out with a smaller thing that I'm actually pretty well versed on. This is something that we expected. Over the last few years, the MMORPG Guild Wars 2 has been releasing yearly expansions kind of in the middle of the summer era. So we're right at the time of that. They've announced their next yearly expansion, Guild Wars 2 Visions of Eternity. So to try to actually boil this down, people, things that don't play this game might actually be interested in. Like, Guild Wars 2 has been releasing these yearly expansions for 3 years now. This is the third one of three. So it seems to be, I think, at a high level, the two things that are interesting about this that are, A, finally we have a kind of a consistent cadence for Guild Wars 2 announcements. For the past 12 years, it's been very like, we're doing an expansion this year. We're not doing an expansion this year. We're done with expansion. So never mind. It was very hodgepodge and very whoever was game director at the time doing whatever they wanted. So the fact that we're kind of at like a regular cadence of announcement, release, is like, thank God it only took them 12 years or more, but here we go. And the other main thing here is that one expansion content that most players had kind of written off as a thing of the past that we would never see again is the idea of elite specs. Elite specs are basically like prestige classes. Back in the first set of expansions, every existing class would get a new prestige class. And that's kind of what an expansion was. They didn't add new classes, but you'd get new prestige classes for existing players. Your guardian can now become a dragon hunter. Oh, next expansion, it can now become a wheelbender. And people kind of thought, oh, that's going away. Now we're at the back half of the game's life. We're never going to see that again. But they kind of surprised us and they said, nope, we're bringing back elite classes. Like that, this, despite being a yearly expansion, we're going to do this again. So I think that was a surprise to players. And I wish I could go into more detail, but they haven't actually announced what all of those are. They've announced that they're going to bring them back. And now from the announcement of the expansion to its release in October, it's going to release on October 28th, they're going to kind of dole those out and go into each one in detail in turn. So I think that's kind of a surprise for the players, but a welcome one. And they're going to reveal that information over the upcoming weeks and months. And then I think the last shout out here that I personally have is Tony, a friend of the site, Tony Garso, contributor at Nova Crystallis. He was like, the new Visions of Eternity expansion sure looks a lot like Dawn Trail in terms of being like a Islander kind of aesthetic in terms of the theming or the vibe of the expansion. And the answer is like, yeah, it kind of is in terms of going to a new area that is a far off island that people haven't visited before, that we don't know much about. And there's no existing lore for it. There's no there's really no precedent for like what could this area contain. There's nothing in Guild Wars 1. There's nothing in the lore books about what this area is. So it is kind of ArenaNet finally for the first time in a while doing something in terms of like having a blank slate in terms of there's no preconceived notions of what this area could be. We have a theme that we like in terms of the Islander kind of vibe, and we're gonna see where that plays out. So I'm looking forward to this.
I have two questions. Obviously. One, do you think these yearly like kind of expansions have been working out in terms of, you know, I remember when they basically said we're no longer doing like the big, you know, expansion every 2 or 3 years. Now we're doing kind of like these yearly updates. I remember, you know, there was some hesitation there. Like, are these even going to be worth it? Are these just going to be just, you know, bare minimum type of updates? Like how have they been?
I think for a game that's in its second decade of life, they've been fine. And I know fine sometimes we use as like almost a pejorative, but I think it's been like they're supporting the game well. There's a decent amount of content. It's the sort of thing where it's like if someone had been playing this game, but they've taken a break and they're like, all right, I have 2 years to catch up on. It's like you actually have a fair bit to catch up on. It's not like a game that's in maintenance mode that it's like, don't worry, they haven't added anything substantially. You haven't missed much. It's like, no, it's actually been a decent amount of stuff. But I also don't think that anyone's like, no one that has their head on straight is deluded into thinking that it's the same level of content as in like the first decade of the game. And it goes back to the thing that's always been ArenaNet's kind of bugbear is that they got to get another project out. Like they've been working on things behind the scenes that they have never announced. They bring on developers who will proudly announce that they're working at ArenaNet and they're working on a non-Guild Wars project. And then the project dies or doesn't go anywhere, nothing comes out of it, or you have an art station that gets made public and says, oh, ArenaNet was working on a Dune game, but that never got released. And that's the sort of thing where it's like Guild Wars 2 is getting plenty of support for existing players and for even like lapsed players, that it doesn't feel like a game in maintenance mode, though the cadence is slowed down. But I don't think anyone's like surprised or disheartened by that. And I think the fact that despite being on the yearly model, they're saying, nope, we still have the gusto to do elite specs, which basically means there are 9 playable specs. We're going to add nine new playable specs effectively in this yearly cadence. It's like, that's not a small ask. Like they're doing some pretty substantial stuff, but it just goes back to, all right, ArenaNet, what's your new thing? It's got to be something, right? You have more people working at you than you have in like the last 5 years.
At least they're being better off than, say, Bungie, where Mikhail did find the thing I was talking about earlier. Like Bungie, like they just released their new Destiny 2 expansion, and the peak players is like less than a third of what the last 3 expansions have been on Steam. So, I mean, maybe not great for them.
And I guess I just wanted to do a little like, so people aren't totally lost by your remark about Mikhail's thing, because you were talking about like you guys were trying to find a game that was presumably published by Playism earlier, and you guys found out it was Urban Myth Dissolution Center, but that's not by Playism, it was Shueisha. It's just to clear up, you know, context for that.
I think what confused me is that whenever I saw it, I was at like indie showcases where they were like literally right next to.
Yeah. Okay. Sorry about the little tangent, because I didn't want people to get totally lost by that remark.
No worries. But in terms of Guild Wars 2, like how it lives currently, is they're finally trying to simplify, and I know when people say simplify, like, oh, that's not good, they're streamlining, but it really is. Over the years of development, they've kind of got this hat on a hat philosophy where they've got dungeons, and then they've got fractals, and those are two similar but different things, and then they've got strikes, and then they've got raids, and those are two similar but different things, and they're trying to like unify the systems a bit to be like, nope, we're going to call them all raids now. Anything that was previously deployed as a strike, we're going to rejigger as a raid, and that way it just like the reward schemas are more unified in terms of like what the player expects. This not released yet, so we don't know like what the outcome will be, but will be more unified. And the raids that they've released have been decently challenging. I've been reading the Reddit, and as someone who hasn't played Final Fantasy 14, I was trying to like find a point of comparison, and they're like very clearly in the savage tier of a Final Fantasy 14 raid in terms of like expectations, difficulty, things like that, with maybe one of them leaning into the ultimate territory. But that's something that has been Guild Wars like Achilles heel for a while, is that it had decent end game content, but nothing that was on the same challenging level as other options. And they've been kind of pushing in that direction a lot harder in the last 2 years. I'm not saying it's like it's on par, but it's definitely improving and kind of improving quickly. So like as someone who used to have all of the available in-game achievements for all of the endgame crew content, I haven't been able to keep up because it's been more challenging. It's been releasing more frequently. And it's like, all right, they really kind of got some people on staff that have maybe played the other options in WoW and in FF14 and want to give some sort of on the same level experience in Guild Wars 2. So that's something that if your expectations with Guild Wars 2 are circa 2018, it has changed a bit in the last, you know, half a decade. But obviously, they're releasing this a little bit later than they have the last two. The last two released like in the end of summer. This one's coming out at the end of October, so right in that holiday window. So giving it a little bit more time to work on it, maybe it'll be a little bit more substantial at release in terms of the amount of content to play through. But obviously, as the go-to guy for that for this podcast, I will report back at the end of October and see if they've nailed it or if they've whiffed. And of course, I always hope that ArenaNet will come and say, we're announcing something that's completely not Guild Wars related. I would, as weird as it might hear, like, I would love that to say, like, we're releasing something that's completely different, not related to an existing IP at all, might not even be an MMO. I would love to just see that. Just do something else.
I mean, that's all ArenaNet has done since 2006, right? It's Guild Wars. That's what they do.
Yeah. One, how many expansions deep are they now with this? And two, wasn't there like a project several years ago that ArenaNet eventually had to shutter, and I guess they continued to double down on Guild Wars after they shuttered? I'm trying to remember
what it was. The answer is, this is expansion 6, though the first 3 were at that like 2 to 3 year cadence, and the last 3 are at their 1 year cadence, so it's not quite apples to apples. Mm-hmm. Like expansions 1, 2, and 3 just by proxy or by default have more content, feel like more traditional expansions. Then the last 3 feel like yearly updates, and they're still pretty good, but just it's not quite the same level. And in terms of other projects, that's the tricky part, is that they've never formally announced anything, but we learn secondhand that projects have died or the talent has left. This is like Glassdoor listings, ArtStation profile releases, things like that, where they're like, oh, it turns out the big one in the last 2 years was, I think, artists that were working at ArenaNet putting on their ArtStation unused concepts for a Dune MMO. And they never announced a Dune MMO, but apparently they were working on one, and apparently it's dead. There were some rumors, and I might not have all the details here, but there were some rumors that they were working on with Sony for a Horizon MMO that's no longer in the works. Like, and I, these are the sorts of like speculation that changes so frequently that I might not have the most contemporary as we know it information. So if people have been following, they might be like, well, we thought this, but actually it's this. But at a bottom line, they've never announced anything else formally, and they've never canceled it. They just have lingered in the Guild Wars space for
15 I guess it's years. Impressive and scary that, like, you know, Guild Wars both 1 and 2 has been enough to keep ArenaNet as seemingly afloat as they are for this many years, just solely built on the back of those two projects.
Yep.
That's scary, in my opinion.
The only other thing is that I guess at an NCSoft, who is their parent company, a Korean studio, investor meeting like a year and a half ago, like some suit said they're working on Guild Wars 3. And people are like, oh shit, Guild Wars 3. But really, they've clarified and they've said, like, we're in pre-planning, brainstorming, nothing's been written for Guild Wars 3 sort of thing. Like, it's not really an active development. It's in pre-production, maybe, in terms of, like, where we were, you know, the usual boilerplate thing where they're like, we're always looking at where we can leverage our IPs in the future, whether that's a sequel or something else. So they're very,
I don't even know, like, what do you how you release an MMO in this landscape, and not just in this landscape, but moving forward also, like, what does a brand new, I guess, borderline AAA MMO look like from the ground up?
The entire environment's so different now with Koyo likes and mobile offerings competing in that same space.
Right. And especially with their model where it's like always been like, it's, as far as I know, they've never done like the base model is free to play. You still have to buy in as a premium game, right?
I think it's free to play now.
It's it's free to play. Technically it's free to play, but you have a lot of limitations if you're free to play. None of the expansion content is free to play, and if you're free to play, you're very limited in what you can do. So it's like it's free to play by the skin of its teeth.
I see. Yeah. So, but it's like it's way more preferable if like you're starting out to just, you can't play free to play, but I guess it's maybe commonly understood that it's probably more preferable to just buy it out of the gate.
The for anyone entering right now, the normal point of entry is that the first three expansions are like bundled together, I think, for like $30 or $40. And that's kind of like your launching point, is that you have like basically the first decade of updates in a single package. I forget what it's called, but
how often do they go on sale? Do they go on sale pretty consistently?
I have no idea.
Okay. Yeah.
Don't worry, Aeon 2 is going to save everybody.
There we go. Oh, I had my price completely wrong. The Elder Dragon Saga Complete Edition on Steam with no discounts is $100. So never mind.
Okay, all right. Yeah, that's a pretty severe price difference. What you're saying.
I mean, you can make the argument that it's still like it's 10 decades worth. It's 10 years worth of content.
Therefore, you're still getting a lot of hours out of that.
Yeah, but still, $100 price is difficult for anyone to ask. But anyway, this is more than I want to talk about it. I will revisit obviously when the expansion launches in 3 or 4 months. In terms of other announcements, this was a game that I read the announcement here, and I read it twice, and I'm like, I have no idea what this is. The headline is Fantasy Maiden Wars Dream of the Stray Dreamer is releasing for PC, Steam, and Switch this year. And Fantasy Maiden Wars is similar sounding to Super Robot Wars. Apparently this game is built in that vein, though I have no idea how much connective tissue there is between the two of these. All right, so Josh, elucidate us, educate us on what is Fantasy Maiden Wars.
Yeah, so you know, the well of Toho fan-made games is very, very deep, very, very well-storied. You know, for any genre you can think of, there's probably at least 1 to 2 Toho fan games made of it, because that IP is just so, it's really embraced that like openness of the IP. Like the owner of Toho, Zune, is very like lets people make whatever the fuck they want with it, pretty much, and it's really enriched that whole IP by making it more widespread and making it, you know, people make whatever they want off of that. So Fantasy Maiden Wars, its original Japanese name is Genso Shoujo Taisen, which is very emblematic of the Super Robot Taisen series, which is known as Super Robot Wars, is very much like a Toho-themed Super Robot Wars game. It doesn't try to hide it. It is very much made in the love and care that the Super Robot Wars games are made of. Like I said, turn-based tactical gameplay with very elaborate battle animations for their characters, and it has a massive roster. This one has like over 70 playable characters, you know, that all have like their own animations for each character and so forth. I've heard about this game a lot. A friend of mine has been trying to get me to play this forever because there's been fan translation efforts on like several like versions of the game. For context, Kite did a fantastic write-up about like the the legacy of this game, where there are four episodic games. All of them are pretty meaty. There's like Ko, Yo, A, and Mu. And like the very first one came out in December 2009 at Comiket 77 physically. Then they eventually got digital releases from 2016 to 2018, but they were all sold at Japanese convention events from like 2009. Then the next one came out 2012, then 2014, then 2017. So like it's been around for quite a while and only got digital releases like, you know, as far back as 2018. And then even along that journey, there's been fan translation efforts, you know, to, I don't think it ever got like a full fan translation, but like several years ago now, I don't exactly know like the exact legacy of like when those came out, but one of my friends is like super in love with this game, like to the point that like his evaluation and appreciation of Super Robot Wars is measured by does it stack up to Fantasy Maiden Wars, because the way that this game like integrates its mechanics and the way that you build up characters is like it matches the challenge of the game. Like a common complaint of Super Robot Wars is like the balance is usually always off, and like, and it has a lot of like very negligible mechanics, like terrain, for example. It's in a lot of modern contemporary Super Robot Wars games feels like something that you don't really think about, because a lot of the stage design in those games is very like very flat, very boring. It's kind of like almost like a flat surface on land that you just kind of like, you know, steamroll through with your giant robots, while in this game there's enough stage variety that like their terrain stats do matter. So you have to think about like, you know, party composition more than like Super Robot Wars, because of like, hey, there might be a certain characters that do better on a stage because of the way it's designed and so forth. And there's also
I was gonna say, you know, when you talk about terrain, I actually never noticed about terrain now that you mentioned about it.
When exactly.
I think they know that their players don't look at the terrain, so they added like bonus conditions trying to get you, encourage you to play better, like the SP.
Yeah, but even then, the way that they've designed those mini objectives for those have been so dull, or like, because usually those conditions like, hey, beat the clear all enemies like within 7 turns, you know. So it's like it's discouraging turtle mechanics, but it's still not really enough to like make interesting. Like older SRW games are like, hey, beat this unit, this boss unit, you have to completely destroy it, not get it below a certain HP threshold before it retreats. So you have to actually think about like, you know, when to use your buffs and what sort of like united party attacks you're doing on the boss to get enough damage for it to destroy it. Because if it retreats under that HP threshold, instead of getting its HP to 0, you wouldn't get that SP. That sort of design isn't really in many contemporary modern SRW games anymore, because those SP conditions are tricky and they do force the player to think about and strategize to get that SP, and that it feels like SRW isn't getting more and more away from that sort of like those conditions, which are real. It's a kind of a real bummer in that regard. So either way, that like it seems like Fantasy Maiden Wars is really, really fulfills that enriching gameplay that like older SRW games used to provide. Like even like the presentation of this game, you can tell it's like, hey, it's made in the same style and vein as those older PS1 and PS2 era Super Robot Wars games. And a good friend of mine, and also has been one of the prominent lead translators in the modern SRW English releases, Christina Rose, who goes by Dramata on online, both in social media and, you know, other circles, announced this project on her Blue Sky and wrote up like a great, fantastic thread about like the journey up to this release, because it's been like, this is a well-storied release for people who know about it and who have played it and have been trying to like, you know, spread the word about it. But like for me, I didn't want to go through the hassle of like trying to track down copies of this game and apply fan translations. I'm like, I kind of wish there was like an easier way to play it. That's why I never got around to playing it. But now this is coming out officially through Steam, And it's kind of a, it's a kind of like the best case scenario, because Christina used to work on some of those earlier fan translations, not as a lead translator, but offering, you know, proofreading and error checking. And eventually, the publisher of this upcoming release for Fantasy Maiden Wars, Phoenix, reached out to her, and they were able to work out, like, even the when she ran the numbers, it still wasn't feasible to do a ground up new translation from the ground up for this game because the sheer amount of text. But they were able to reach out to the original fan translators of the title and basically ask, like, hey, can we use your script as a foundation, and we'll touch it up, and I'd obviously translate the rest of the content that you guys weren't able to, you know, get to. And they were able to get the entire fan translation's, like, blessing on this upcoming release, and, like, get the green light from them saying, hey, yes, we give you our permission to use the script as a foundation, and you can reach a middle ground solution where we can touch up your script and continue translating what you weren't able to get to for a complete fan translation. Cool. To get a complete translation of all the content that Fantasy Maiden Wars has ever gotten.
Yeah, you hear a lot of those kind of stories, but I don't know, some kind of burn their bridges because of like certain crazy people in teams, but no, this sounds like a good news.
Yeah, it feels like this, like, the best case scenario to, like, all the parties all around, and finally getting, like, you know, the well-deserved recognition and official release that Fantasy Maiden Wars absolutely deserves, you know, based on what I've heard about it. From every person who's played this game and who's an SRW fan, they're like, this is one of the best SRW games ever made. And, like, no one's, you know, obviously because of how tricky it is to, like, find it and play it and apply the patches, like, you know, it hasn't gained like a huge following. But hopefully with this release, now that it's, like, easily, you know, accessible, you know, I definitely want to hop on this and you know, play it. I know it'll take me many hours because it seems like a very, very lengthy game with all of these episodes of the game. But I'm so happy for Christina and the team, all the teams that are involved in this, just getting this, you know, making this a reality. It's just such a fantastic feel-good story that, like, I will 10,000% support when it comes out.
And then the last thing we have listed here as an announcement is something that I think Mikhail had a chance to speak to. It's a game I know nothing about, Warframe. So Warframe is available on Switch. You have some information about a Switch 2 version?
Yeah, so basically, as of this recording, TennoCon 2025, the 10th anniversary of the event, is going on. The podcast will obviously go up after that, but before the event, they had a media preview, pre-briefing thing to cover what they're going to announce for Warframe, which is the next narrative quest, which is coming this year, a tease for next year. They've been doing a lot for the game. Like, they got Ben Starr on it. They got, like, some of the people from Periphery, a metal band, to do music for the new narrative quest, which was Warframe 1999. A lot of stuff happening with Warframe. And yeah, it's a cross-platform live service game available on everything, including mobile. But the thing is, the, like, you know, with live service games and games as a service, it's running via backward compatibility on Switch. And this was one of the games which had some issues which had to be fixed, and they got fixed a few weeks after launch on Switch. So I was curious what they were doing with Switch 2, because we had Fortnite launch day one with the Switch 2. And I was like, what's happening with Warframe? Because that's a game I actually want to play on Switch 2, because right now it runs and looks way better on my iPhone than it does on Switch. So during a group Q&A session, I asked, are there any plans to do a native Switch 2 version? To which I got a response that right now it's the Switch 1 version, but the tech team is excited for the potential with the Switch 2 features and to, like, reduce the load times and stuff. But right now they're still waiting on dev kits, which I found a little surprising, that how is Digital Extremes, who makes Warframe, like, a super successful game right now, still not able to get dev kits? But yeah, they said that there's like, that's a backlog insane for dev kits. So, like, you know, some of us have heard off the record from some devs, like indie devs, that they aren't able to get dev kits. But to hear it from Digital Extremes was kind of shocking to me. So just that was, like, the second part of why I wanted to, like, publish it as a news story. That one is, a lot of people want to know what's happening with Warframe on Switch 2, because right now the Switch 1 version is capped at 30, kind of low resolution and stuff. So Switch 2 hopefully would allow for 60 FPS and like much better performance, even maybe mouse controls, because that's something which a lot of devs are now adding with varying degrees of success. So it looks like they do want to give out a native Switch 2 version, but they don't have a dev kit yet, unfortunately. So it might be a bit of a long wait for that. So yeah, continue, James.
Yeah, I just, that's all I really want to say too.
Yeah, I do wonder, like, how much, like, obviously there's only a small glimpse behind the scenes on in that regard, but I do wonder how many other developers behind the scenes are kind of hurting from, like, lackluster Switch 2 performance of their titles because they just don't have access to a Switch 2 dev kit to, you know, optimize their game for it, because they don't have the necessary tools to in order to do that at the moment.
I mean, yeah, there was that whole thing with Sekai Project where it's like, some of their games just do not work on Switch 2, so you can't even buy them on the Switch 2 shop. And it's been frustrating to them because they asked, oh, well, can we get a dev kit so we can fix it? And they were like, no. It's like,
that's ridiculous. Like, hello, we have products on your shop that, you know, you've acknowledged that aren't working. Can we get the resources to, you know, fix those up?
And yet they keep promoting those shitty AI slop with those, what is it, those H girls or whatever. So,
and you have AAA alarm clock complete edition.
They're still there, but you know it'll take time to hopefully straighten those out. Obviously, it gets into like really weird ground because of like it was not only just like Nintendo that like revised their policy and their wording of like what's permissible their eShop, but you know Steam had that as well earlier this week, and it's being done to payment processors in that regard, in that aspect too. So it's a little bit of like column A, column B of like we need to do something about this, but what is too much going over the line as well.
And I think that kind of covers it for the kind of announcement, a different sort of announcement section for this week's podcast. No big announcements, but just talking about a few things that are in the works and a few things that developers want to work on. Of course, some announced expansions. Everything from this point forward is updates to previously announced games or previously games that are coming out in the August, September, October timeframe. This is one talking about Switch 2 projects that seemingly are like out of all the Switch 2 games for third party, I think we got news that Cyberpunk 2077, due to the effort that CD Projekt Red has put into it as a physical game on cart, things like that, has done very well for the Switch 2, at least relative to some of the other third-party contemporaries. Cyberpunk 2077 just recently released their update 2.3, as well as, I don't think this was known, and I'm not sure how meaningful it is in terms of the larger scope, but it has a native macOS version now, which I think the last time I've read that in a headline must have been a while ago in terms of a big, quadruple ARPG having a native Mac client in that.
Quadruple ARPG.
Well, what else
did you call Cyberpunk? I know, but that's so funny to hear.
The thing about the Mac version of this game is it was actually announced a while ago and it just went silent. So this kind of happens where developers, they want to bring their game everywhere and I guess it just doesn't make financial sense. But then what's happened recently is you've had Apple, who's partnering with a lot of AAA publishers and developers to help bring their game over. And what's happened with the new Apple M series or Apple Silicon, like M1, M2, M3, M4 chips, it's apparently very easy for developers to bring stuff over, and Apple's also supporting. So we had No Man's Sky come over, like from one of the games which I care about. There's like a lot of other stuff, like Lies of P Overture came. Lies of P itself was, I think, a day one game on Mac. And like, obviously, because like this is something which unless you are on Mac, it wouldn't really matter to you. And also what's happened is, like this is going a bit into the weeds, that some of these games they release only on the Mac App Store for Mac, not on Steam. So if you're on Steam, you don't even see it that it has Mac support. But what CD Projekt Red did is, if you own the game on GOG, Steam, or the Epic Game Store, you get the Mac version for free, or it's also available on the Mac App Store. And this is the Ultimate Edition. So, you know what, like recently they announced a patch 2.3 and they said it's been delayed indefinitely or whatever. I have a feeling this was done because this is all speculation, obviously, that they were waiting to finish the Mac build and they wanted to have it all line up at the same time. And that did happen because they announced it ships with 2.3 on Mac. And then going into the other end of the spectrum, they said it's coming to every platform, but the Nintendo Switch update is delayed to a later date. But the update just shipped 2 hours later or something like that. So I feel like this is also one of those situations where Nintendo, they were waiting on Nintendo to approve the update and that just happened. So yeah, coming back to the Mac thing, ever since Apple's moved over to the M series of chips, there's been a lot more games coming over. A lot of games which are on iOS and Android have also been coming over to Mac because it's apparently very easy if you have a mobile game to just get it to run. And I think there's some gacha games also now which are available on the Mac App Store. Some of, I think Wuthering Waves or Infinity Nikki, like I saw one of them. I can't remember which one though, but like one of them was there. So these things have started popping up here and there. And but more relevant to the site besides the Mac OS version is Cyberpunk 2077 2.3 added new cars, right?
Yeah,
it's been like an inside joke that whenever we release like a guide or a listicle on our site and then the games get updated so that we have to like go back to those and edit them, it's like that happens sometimes. Like even in some of our walkthroughs, like our Suikoden walkthrough, they changed some of the progression in that game, so we had to go back and edit it. But the biggest like example of this over the last 5 years has been our list of vehicles in Cyberpunk 2077, because they have added to that list probably like 7 times at this point. So we joked as soon as they announced that there was going to be an update 2.3 that they were going to announce more cars.
Remember like 2 years ago when they said that this is the final update for Cyberpunk 2077?
Yeah.
Wait till the second season of Edgerunner comes out. Then you probably have a hitter big patch.
Well, they did add like a little mini quest for the, like that is like a very, it's just more of a fan servicey tie-in for the first season. So I would not be surprised at all if they did for the second season, because it's like standalone from each other. But yeah, they added 4 cars. The update itself, it's a lot of under the hood stuff, especially for console. Like it supports, you know, VRR on console now, improved HDR, FSR4 for the VRR. In terms of actual content, they added 4 cars. They added the ability to auto drive. So I guess I've re-downloaded the game, but I've not booted it up since. You pick a location, your car will automatically drive there. And also, I guess if you don't have a location, your car will just meander. It'll just drive, which I don't know.
Honestly, that's pretty sick, to be honest. You just vibe out of the radio.
Yeah, they added that, and they said if you don't have anything to do, you can just set your car to that and listen to the radio and chill.
Yeah,
and I'm like, that's amazing.
That's pretty good, actually. I kind of dig that a lot.
Yeah. But yep, they. I don't know if they've ever said that this is the last update. I don't trust them. It'll be updated more. But obviously, we kind of did like a big, not really a re-review of the game, but you know, the big 2.0 update with Phantom Liberty, all that added a ton of quality of life to the game, and they're continuing to go at it. I forget what they've said, but they have officially confirmed that, you know, whatever the follow-up is in development. So I don't know, like, if the team size, like who's working on Cyberpunk 2 versus who's still on Cyberpunk 1 in terms of the talent at the studio. But CD Projekt has grown so like massive in terms of like their support studios over the last few years that I would not be surprised if they just continue to poke and prod and polish up Cyberpunk for the next several years more. Would not be surprised.
I do hope that these features, like the auto drive, like are like baseline features for the follow up to Cyberpunk.
Yeah, hopefully. Yeah,
like it's just there at the start. Like I would love to just put on auto drive and just kind of listen to the radio, because I'm not the biggest fan of like the driving in Cyberpunk. Like it's not the hook of the game for me. I'd be okay with that. And also an interesting thing, like they I know Delamain Taxi was in there for like mainline story missions, but I think now you can, that's been expanded, like way more missions in the game too, like the taxi service that they have in the game that they added in this recent update. So
yeah, I did see that. I did see that on the list, but I don't quite know how that means it's implemented. But if it's something completely different, I'll report back. But yeah, I imagine, you know, you have the option of driving your own car or requesting a taxi service to go someplace. Now the game does have fast travel, so it's not like a lot of this is for flavor more than for like actual like utility.
Right.
But you say instead of fast traveling to this point, I'm going to hire a taxi. Like the fact that you now are supposedly able to is kind of fun. Just, you know, in universe didactic, or whatever you call it, progression. Our next update here is a little bit of a Falcom corner, both from the, you know, Western side and the Eastern side. So the first thing we have here, of course, we've talked about in the past, ever since its announcement, really, of this weird dichotomy between the global East 10 Nordics and the currently only announced for Japan at this time, East 10 Proud Nordics. We have kind of a small little headline for both this week. So East 10 Nordics, the global version, obviously localized by Durante Studio PH3, did get an update on Steam. The update is a lot of under the hood stuff, improved UI texture, improved shadow sampling, that sort of stuff. But it does just kind of show that despite everything else, they are still tweaking this game to try to make it as, you know, performance, I don't know if spectacle is the right word, but they're PH3, this is kind of their claim to fame, and they are focusing on that for their most recent port in the series, regardless of the status of the Proud Nordics down the line. So East 10 Nordics, the global version on Steam, available in English officially, just got an update. And then for Proud Nordics, we did get a trailer from Falcom talking about its the new gameplay and story content. I think a lot of this is kind of covered from 2 weeks ago or last week, where we talked about it would support 120 FPS gameplay in performance mode. We talked about how the new content was kind of parallel to the existing story that you can jump into or out of at any time. A lot of that Kite reported on very initially as soon as it came off the press in Japan. And then this is just kind of a trailer from Falcom going over that same information. Of course, the release for this is August, but in Japan, of course,
July 31st.
Yeah, in Japan.
I see. Yeah. Okay, August for the Switch 2 and Steam Asia version. My bad. So yeah, July for Switch, July for Japan, August for the other territories. My bad. Good catch.
Yeah. Going back to like the East 10 Nordics, the patch that the global version got. Like, I think it is kind of funny that like Durante Studio had to go out of their way, like, okay, we have to fix this specific Windows 11 24H2 update bug in dropping raw input when alt tabbing. I keep hearing horror stories from Windows 11 bugs. On games.
I remember like over 6 months ago, I got into like not an argument or even a spat, but I said on like 6 months ago, just saying, man, I've heard nothing but horror stories about Windows 11 24H2. And back then I had someone just run into my Blue Sky mentions to be like, oh no, actually most people are having no problems. It's like, I'm sorry. Shit like this keeps happening. Even now, it's like, I don't know what to say. Like, people that say that Windows 11 isn't that great, they're right. Hey, Microsoft needs to fix their shit.
Windows 10 support ends officially in like October, so hooray.
No, extended. I accidentally updated the 11. Oh, won't let me go back to 10. It's the worst piece of shit ever.
Yeah, it's pretty awful. But yeah, just one last thing about the East 10 update is Durante's like PH3 ports have been doing the best support for Steam's recording feature if you've used that. So the timeline, they've added this thing with the timeline where it's in like Daybreak 2 and Daybreak 1 also now that if you use Steam's recording, it can tell when there's a battle and when there's like a cutscene and stuff like that. So when you can like trim easily if you're like going through your recording. And now he's even added this thing where if the background music changes, there'll be a marker on the recording on Steam's timeline thing. So that's like unprecedented support for like the new features which Valve adds. And I think because Valve is so hands off with these things, most devs will just not bother adding these features. So PH3 going above and beyond again to add like super niche stuff.
I remember messing with that crazy feature when it first came out, and it felt fun, but also kind of like I have three other pieces of software that can do this. So, but it is cool to see them really go dive in and get the markers added, something very, like you said, niche. Go ahead, James.
Yeah, it's crazy how like pretty consistently the best PC ports just we ever get these days are Falcom games, just because it's Durante being given essentially a blank check to do whatever the fuck he wants.
Yeah.
And in some cases, they even do their work without getting paid for it. That's not a good way to phrase it, but I think the co-op stuff is like stuff which he worked on like on weekends, like just on his own. Like it wasn't something which they were supposed to do or something like that. That's how he phrased it in the interview, that it's like just a feature which they were allowed to add.
And then the last thing that's in the kind of this Falcom corner is we got the weekly, or basically weekly, character update for the upcoming Trails in the Sky first chapter, releasing globally in September. This week it's Agate Krosner, the I think A level bracer that's introduced in the very first series. So we got that from both, you know, the Japanese seiyuu and the Western voice actor up on the site, which I think leaves us with Tita and Zin. Because we've got everyone else up through Chloe and Olivier the last few weeks. So I think we've got two more. And then we'll see what the kind of the launch media press releases go to from there. In terms of other trailers, actually, before we get to trailers, Heroes is a game that has surprisingly this year had a lot more media than it's had ever since its announcement. This is Witchbrook. So Witchbrook is the kind of like the sim Stardew-ish RPG from Chucklefish that was announced a while back, went silent for a long time, got a Steam page back in like 2022, and then finally in 2025 has really kind of ramped up its social media and PR presence. They've released, the team at Chucklefish has released a new page that is what they're calling DevBlog 1. And DevBlog 1 includes just a lot of different details, some of which under the hood for Witchbrook, about how it works in terms of like scheduling and pathing and rendering. That each of these are like inset little 30-second videos about how certain aspects of the game works. The fact that it's titled DevBlog 1 indicates that they're going to have a series of these. So they're being really open-ended about how this game's development over the years, and it kind of finally ramping close to release. And the one thing, as someone who's not really in the market for this game but has enjoyed kind of following it over these years, the one thing that I really do kind of appreciate is they talk about how in Witchbrook, the game has to manage the schedules of like hundreds of NPCs that have like their own like routines or what they do on a day-to-day basis. Whether you physically follow them in game or not, the game has to track it. So they actually show like a little inset video called A Peek at Debug about what the game looks like under the hood in terms of like how it tracks these things. Now, it's very short. Literally, that video is 11 seconds long. But I feel like a lot of developers are like scared to kind of show that stuff. So as someone who's not in the development space, I still just kind of appreciated that. But yeah, Witchbrook DevBlog 1 up on the site from Chucklefish on the official game site.
It's
really cool stuff.
It's kind of cool like seeing like this sort of behind the scenes, because of like you can really tell like how passionate they are of like really committing to like making like almost this living, breathing, immersive world. Like in terms of like, you know, having a day-night cycle, having like, you know, how over time, you know, about how flowers and plants will like develop, you know, as time goes on, and stuff like that. It kind of reminds of like almost like this vibrant isometric lens of like, it reminds me a lot of like something like Elder Scrolls and Fallout, except it's like this bubbly isometric view perspective, mm-hmm. instead of like first person, like those. It's like it's very much like that Bethesda commitment to having this immersive, living, breathing world outlined in this first dev blog.
And I'm not sure if like the witch school aesthetic is as strong now as it was back in like the late 2010s, but I do feel like this game, I could easily see it taking off. It just feels like it's really going for that Animal Crossing Stardew potion permit Fields of Mistria sort of market. And in a space that really isn't covered by other projects in that space, I don't think, like in terms of witchy, the witchy vibes. So I could easily see this game taking off if it's well received on launch. In terms of other trailer updates, I think I've got two listed here. This first one is for a game that I think we've been talking about basically weekly, because we're doing weekly or at least bi-weekly kind of peek-ins. This is Toa and the Guardians of the Sacred Tree. This is like the isometric, is calling it a Hades-like quite wrong, I'm not sure, but isometric action game, only has multiple different characters that you can play as. This week's, what they call Toa Tuesday trailer, focuses on two characters named Origami and Shigen. I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing those right. but it does a little bit of like a of an animated introduction to both characters, like a 2D movie, followed by a minute of gameplay across each character, out of I believe 8.
So that's a funny clever marketing tactic of coining the Towa Tuesday trailer drops.
Yeah. And so the developer is Brownies, which I don't know if we know if this is a debut project or not, but published by Bandai Namco, who puts their stamp on these trailers. So Bandai is doing a pretty good job, marketing this new IP for a September release.
Brownies has a weird history. I'm talking from the top of my head here, but it's like it was originally Brownie Brown, or at least the person who founded Brownie Brown, who worked at Secret of Mana. They had to leave Brownie Brown to make Brownies, which is like not actually related, but he just gave it a similar title because he felt like it. But it's a weird. I'm gonna look this up now. But
I went to Google Steam Brownies to try to find their Steam page, but instead I got these weird recipes for can I steam brownie mix. I'm like, oh, that was not helpful at all. Anyways, go ahead.
The search engine thing that Adam went off for before the podcast started. So, I mean, at least it's better than Adam's kerfuffle before the podcast.
Oh, yeah. So, Brownie Brown was founded in 2000 by Square alumni Kamioka and Tsuda, who worked on the Mana series. That's who I was thinking of. But then they shut down. They went through a change in structure in 2013, and Kamioka left to form Brownies after that. And Brownies has worked on stuff like Eglia. They worked on Doraemon Story of Seasons, and now Towa. So if you go far enough back, you have Mana DNA here, Mana series.
But yeah, we'll continue to get these little weekly trailers, these Towa Tuesday trailers. It looks like they're releasing the characters in sets of 2. I think it's 8. Don't quote me on that. I'm trying to look at they show some of the menus in the most recent trailer about all the playable character options. But we'll keep covering this game, and it's also slated for that mid September release, September 18th and 19th, depending on your region. And then the last trailer that I have listed here is for Where Winds Meet, which is like a Wuxia open world action RPG that was first announced a while back, I think, 2022. Still doesn't have official release window. I will say, in preparation for this podcast, this is a story trailer focusing on the character of General Wang Xing. Thank you, Chao. And I was like, all right, I'm going to watch this trailer so that I can speak to it in the podcast. And I watched it and I'm like, I don't know what I watched. Like, I don't understand what's going on. But it's like a fully animated 3-minute long movie, effectively, of a lot of betrayal, a lot of people dying, a lot of battles. And I was like, I don't know what I'm watching, but I enjoy the vibes of this. So I don't know
from what I remember of like the closed beta test, the intro was like really fucking weird on how to introduce your playable character, because from my vague memory of what I can recall of that intro was like you were playing as what you learned of later on was your father. Your father was like had this like tranquil lifestyle. Then all of a sudden, like there's like this group trying to like was looking for him and trying to subdue him. So they go after him on horseback. He gets on his horseback, and there's a lot of fucking flashy wuxia fight choreography happening in this scene. And then it like fast forwards several years later, where like your playable character is like actually like a baby growing up, and like you can actually start customizing them. And the scene that like happens to start customizing them is like they're doing their daily training routine, and like the reflection of the sword goes over your character model's face, and that's where you start actually customizing your character. It's like, what is the reflection that the sword shows? And it's like, what the fuck is this? it's like very unexpected. It's like, what the like? I still don't even know like what like if they're gonna have that segment in the final game or not. But I'm like, that's crazy, because I would have never guessed that's like how they introduced your playable character that you make in that game.
So is it still a free to play game, or do they go?
I have no idea. I think it's still free to play, but I don't quote me on that. I have no idea. Like that's still like how the final release is. It feels like that's like an established integral part of the game, but
I heard good things about this game, but the monetization is kind of like what has me worried.
Now, this game is already out in China.
Is it?
Yeah.
I haven't heard anything about it. Like, is it like, how long ago did it come out?
I want to say like last December.
Wow. Yeah, I haven't heard anything about it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, like even on the Steam store page, like it like the final bullet points are like, hey, this is, you can play this with up to 4 friends, seamless co-op, and it emphasizes you can build or join a guild to unlock group activities like guild wars and multiplayer dungeons and raids. So it is an integral part of the game that like that free-to-play structure feeds into.
But yeah, I was going to go back to that sword reflection part, how your character is not the introduction character. Because a lot of Wuxia stories that are like, I don't know, from Jin Yong, for example, like the Kanto heroes, like his stories, like the main character in his stories, like half the time, don't show up till like 5 hours into the story. So I feel it's kind of like that kind of sentiment, you know, when you talk about your character reflection in the sword kind of thing, right?
Uh-huh. Yeah.
So, like one of the stories
Go ahead.
Sorry. I was saying like one of the main characters is basically like the son of the father that gets betrayed and then he gets killed. Then like eventually when the son's finally born, that's the main character for the rest of the story, right? So, but you know, it doesn't show up till at least 5 hours into the story.
So I was reading some of the Steam pages to try to learn like what people have like what people are expecting. You know, it's always dangerous going into the Steam forums, but like apparently it has like 10-man raid type content that is MMO like, but the worlds are kind of like almost like hub based where you only might see like 30 players in your instance. And I feel like we need like a title for that sort of game. So it's like kind of hub like a Monster Hunter, but not quite. I almost think of like Fallout 76, where it's an online world. It's not really an MMO, but there might be 30 other players in your map that you can team up with.
How about PSO New Genesis? Like, is it sort of like that?
Actually, honestly, kind of like that, because PSO, I haven't played that game in like 2 years, but it does have like exploration zones. So it'll actually say like there are 12 of 30 players, you know, max in this current zone. So MMO-ish. They call it open world action game, but with multiplayer components, I suppose. Yeah. And one other just small thing is that they did say, this is already announced, but they reminded at the end of the trailer, is that it does have, I think it's second of its two global beta tests at the end of this month, end of July. They had one, I believe, in May, and then this one for July. The release is slated for 2025, but no window. So I'm guessing at the end of the beta test, they'll reconvene and decide whether they're released for this year or push it back.
I guess like if you rewire your brain to think of this more like a PSO New Genesis type release, maybe it becomes more clear like what the nature of this game is. Then
that's also free to play. Yeah,
yeah. So and you know obviously this will have like a somewhat more involved battle system. Looks like than PSO New Genesis because it's more like Wuxia focused, different stances, different weapon types. You know, so that's and like you're you know. Making contact with the enemy.
Yeah, like well. I'm okay with like maybe like MMO business model like FF14 or PSO, but if it's like a gacha game,
I have no idea like if there's like a gacha element in this game. Maybe it is more like PSO, but like PSO does have a gacha element, but I don't know how intrusive that
it's,
is.
It's like cosmetic gacha. It's like so you can get certain outfits that are purely microtransaction in terms of you must pay premium currency that you spend money on to get this, or it's like you get tickets as you play and then you pull to try to get these. But if you don't get them, you can buy more tickets. So
So I guess it's more like
old school microtransactions rather than like characters or SSRs or things like that. Yeah.
I think the last time we talked about this game, it's like James discovered like the map of this game and like all the collectibles that pop up on.
Oh yeah, I read that rings the bell. Yeah,
and then, like and then he jump scared us when he shared it. It's like oh that's an ocean of markers on that.
Yeah.
We have the trailers up online. It's like a 3-minute movie that. Is interesting and flashy, though I can't say I fully comprehend it. And then, yeah, we have an upcoming beta test at the end of the month that you can sign up for, I believe, now. In terms of I guess the rest of this podcast, as we kind of wrap up, is some upcoming dates, release dates, and a few other things. This one, we could have put it in like the trailer section. We got a teaser trailer for a project called Goddess Order, which is a mobile action RPG being developed by Pixel Tribe and published by Kakao Games. The teaser is only 40 seconds long with a little snippet of gameplay, but they're going to do a full showcase of what exactly Goddess Order is on the 23rd of July. So at this time next week, we'll be able to look at the full trailer for this game and see exactly what it is.
Yeah, from what I remember, because this game has been in development for quite a while, it got like a soft launch in some Southeast Asian territories like Malaysia, New Zealand, Singapore. Everything I've heard about this game, like a lot of people really like the story in this game, the how the story is told in this game. It's like it's a 2.5D like action game, and I'm not sure exactly how the monetization, you know, goes into it. I'm not sure if like playing for characters and or weapons or whatnot, but all I've heard, it's like people like have generally nice things to say about like the story and the characters. And like, oh, okay, might be something here.
And this is a game we also kind of talked about a few weeks ago, that is also having a beta test. The beta test signups begin in July, but I don't know if we actually have dates or when the test itself is. This is for Blue Protocol Star Resonance. Now, as a reminder, they're kind of adopting the Blue Protocol name for an existing Tencent project, Star Resonance, but it's not really related to the original Blue Protocol that Amazon was going to publish globally and then canceled. So, yeah, I think we kind of drilled through that weird specification like 2 months ago. That it has the Blue Protocol name, but as far as I know, it's pretty much different from what Blue Protocol was. Different development team, different art style, different gameplay. But they're using the name because they own the IP now, I suppose.
Yeah,
it's not Blue Protocol. Go ahead.
Yeah, the there's not a traditional MMO like the original Blue Protocol. There's like a more of a Genshin Impact-esque separate project, as you mentioned, that's just co-opted the Blue Protocol IP brand.
It released in China like this month as just Star Resonance. So the Blue Protocol : Star Resonance is only like a weird like name utilization for the global market, even though it's not like Blue Protocol released here. We have no, you know, attachment to that name, but that's what they're using. So weird, but it is what it is. But yeah, beta test signups will be at the end of the month, July 24th. I'm trying to see like when the actual beta test is, but as far as I know, they haven't stated it. We have the trailer that says this is our beta test recruitment trailer. Sign up now.
We have not.
Gotcha. Megan Trey wasn't missing it. But yeah. I accidentally closed my podcast outline tab. Let me bring it back up. Next thing. Not a beta test, but an early access. We have Frosthaven releasing in Steam Early Access at the very end of the month on July 31st. This is a dark fantasy tactical RPG from Snapshot Games. We have the Hyperdimension Neptunia Rebirth Trilogy launching for PlayStation 4 on September 30th. James, in the blurb for this, you said something like, here's hoping things go smoothly this time around. What do you mean by that?
Well, the whole stuff where like the Switch versions of these games were supposed to come out over a year ago and then were indefinitely delayed and then canceled like last minute because of guideline stuff on Nintendo's end.
Oh yeah, I remember Adam and I were talking about it. It's like that's really weird that they just kind of like completely wiped it off the face of the planet like very last minute. It was like within like the same week, I think. It was very near.
And it wasn't even their fault. It was like Nintendo. And like now with the stuff with like the payment processors on Steam, it seems like we are might be heading in a direction where things are a lot more restrictive, which, and keep in mind with these games, they're all rated T.
Yeah.
And Nintendo still said no to them. So it's like,
And they were all sold on retail several years ago. It's probably still on store shelves for several versions of that game on store shelves right now. So, you know, it's a nightmare in terms of all, like, you know, how the payment processors are kind of dictating what can and can't be sold.
This one is a game that we have kind of covered intermittently on the site, the Life is Strange series of games. Life is Strange Retail Collection is announced releasing on October 2nd for PS5. As far as I can tell, this will include True Colors and Double Exposure, the two recent games, as well as having digital access to Life is Strange 1 and 2. Mikhail, did I get those details right?
Yeah, so this is basically bundling all the Life is Strange games available on PS5 in a single retail package. And when I saw the email, I was like, okay, I don't have physical copies of the newest one, so maybe I can get this. Then I saw all of them together. I'm like, oh, perfect. It's probably like the Kingdom Hearts collection, which is like on 3 discs for PS4 or whatever. But no, it's just they've included the remaster collection as a code again. It was like a pre-order or like a digital upgrade thing for, I believe it was True Colors. In the Ultimate Edition, you had the remasters of Life is Strange and Life is Strange Before the Storm included. No physical copy of that. So I thought this was the one chance they'd do that, but no. So it's just, you got all the details correct. I'm just like ranting about Square Enix cheaping out on a physical release. But yeah, this is them either doing this to like bundle everything together, and the way they're phrasing it, maybe they're not doing anything more with the IP, because this kind of feels like a definitive, here's everything, Life is Strange, we're done with it. Or maybe I'm reading too much into it, but that's what that collection feels like to me. And it's a $60 bundle with everything, releasing in October. I feel like we might be having this conversation about a Switch to physical next year, just speculation. And there's a very good chance James and I will be ranting about it being a key card. So just speculation again. But yeah.
I mean, it's obvious in hindsight, but I didn't even catch that. Oh yeah, Square Enix would be the publisher of that. So
yeah.
So there you go. And then the very last headline I have here is a delay announcement. This is for the upcoming Inazuma 11 Victory Road, the forever giant soccer RPG level 5 monstrosity of a game, which was supposed to launch on August 21st. Level 5 has announced that they are pushing it back, and it's going to be releasing on November 13th. The platforms are still PS5, PS4, Switch 2, Xbox
Series. If Hino does not personally delay a game every 6 months, he will die.
So, dude, keep delaying it forever then.
I mean, that's kind of people are well used to this project getting delayed. Man, there's like what, the 8th or 9th, maybe 10th delay of this whole game. This the saga of this game is,
wasn't ever it since supposed it was, to come out before COVID.
Yeah, this was originally announced as like Inazuma 11 Ares or something. You know what? Hold on.
No, that's right. It was here. Ares. It had a different name.
Yeah. This was first announced like 8 years ago. Late July 2016. This was Inazuma 11 Ares was announced, and then that project eventually, throughout many, many years, morphed into this game as the scope became bigger and bigger and bigger. So, you know, it's kind of the norm for this game throughout its, you know, 8-year development cycle when it was publicly announced. Probably more because, you know, there was still some pre-development before it was publicly announced and then morphed into this super game monstrosity. It's probably a... Look, in terms of like scheduling stuff, like this really benefits me because I want to get to SRW in late August. So, okay, yeah. I don't need 2 super games in August to worry about. But I sure hope they meet that November release date before they inevitably have to like announce it again, and then maybe into next year. Then if they delay it again, maybe it'll go to next year. You know, it's like, oh, here we go again. Man, I'm excited and anxious and worried about this game when it comes out, man. When it comes out, if it comes out.
Did you play the beta test that happened recently?
Yeah. I talked about it here. Yeah, I talked about it. That underwent like significant changes and enhancements throughout that beta test. Like that beta test like ran for like 4 to 5 months, to be honest.
Man, I feel like this game might get scope creeped again and delayed again. Constantly.
Dude, I don't know how you scope creep. The scope creep is they've already reached that cap. Like the scope of this game is like, yes, we have it. Like, you know, they have we have over 1,100 returning Inazuma 11 characters to save. It's like, okay, great. We have like a mode where you can build like a village or town. It's like, okay, great. We have like two fucking modes to play this game. One's like a turn-based menu-driven mode. It's like, okay, we have fucking tournament modes supported in this game, and it's crossway. It's like, okay, and there's like two separate like story modes. One's like a legacy mode that like goes through the entire history of Inazuma 11, like from all their past games, and one is like a completely new story mode, like that's just for this game, like the Victory Road exclusive, like new crew, new story, and it's like, and you go around town like not playing soccer, but you. There's like turn-based battles that aren't soccer in that mode as well. It's like, okay, like I don't know how you scope creep this game because they have every fucking thing in this game already.
Yeah. and to be clear, like we were having this exact same conversation about Fantasy Life like not even 3 months ago. And then
and so it's like that's why I'm like excited. Like this is like the ultimate game, but also how do you make a profit out of this game, dude? You spent like I'm not gonna say it. They spent GTA levels of money. That'd be crazy. But sometimes it feels like it with how much stuff they crammed into this project, man.
Yeah, they're lucky though that like after Fantasy Life, people were paying attention to Level 5. They know who they are again. So
yeah,
if there was any chance for this to pop off, I think after Fantasy Life somehow blew up. It's like, I don't know, man.
Pull off this game, I will fucking sing Level 5 praises for a good amount of months. If they somehow pull off this game.
Like, you know what? I'm a believiever. I believe in the plan.
Oh, here we go. Yeah, all right.
Yeah, because, like, again, like I said, I keep thinking back to that one demo I played for, like, Deca Police 2 years ago at TGS. Mm-hmm. I was like, man, this is fucking incredible. If they can stick the landing, it's like, I don't know. Maybe all the people at Level 5 are just like complete fucking madmen, but in the best possible ways.
You know what? You're right. And we get like we always have to mention this about Level 5. A baseline feature in this game is it's fully cross-play amongst all those systems
and cross-save.
Yeah. So, you know.
Fuck it, I'll play it. I've never played an Inazuma 11 in my life, but apparently that's not a requirement because the game is being designed for people like me.
Yeah, because you're getting all the Inazuma 11 you could ever want.
You can play your 200-hour RPG mode Inazuma 11 like series recap within this game is one of 18 modes that it has.
Yeah,
but yep. November. What did I say the date was? I just had it.
November 13th.
November 13th.
Yeah. Thank
you know what? I think it probably will actually release then. I think so, because it's actually dated, so...
I mean, they also dated, too, to August 21st. They had a release date before this one, so...
At least the reason they've delayed it is because they just needed more localization time, so it probably is content complete, at least.
Oh, okay, then probably is ready, yeah.
Yeah, they're being transparent. Hey, you just need more time for voice recording, and since it's a multi-language localization... Other ladies. So they're doing this so like the worldwide simultaneous release for it is true to its word, and like there's no compromises to the quality of it, like if it were to release earlier. So you know, I get it.
Looking at Adam's 2025 RPG list, and it's the only one listed for November.
Let's go.
All you need.
In the last couple days of October, you get Outer Worlds 2, Dragon Quest 1 and 2. And then mid-October, we've got, like, Pokemon Legends. So, yeah, we'll be playing plenty of things in November, even if that's the only November release we've got listed so far. And as happens every year, more things will be announced. And I guess speaking of, you know, the RPG calendar, again, just, you know, Adam keeps up our really great RPG, you know, calendar month by month, even, like, ports or late editions. Looking at next week, it looks like next week's topic will primarily be Wu Chang Fallen Feathers. This is a Chinese Souls-like that was announced a while back that we've been covering throughout this year as it leads up to its July release. James was able to cover it earlier in March. When did you get a chance to play this? I'm trying to think what you were doing in March, James. That's what it was. So that was the last time we covered it in full, but we'll talk about its full release next week. So I think that covers us for the topics of this episode of the TetraCast. As always, if you've listened to this podcast to the very end, thank you so much for listening. Whether it's on the site or on your podcast service of choice, go ahead and leave us a like, leave us a rating, leave us a comment. We love to see those. Follow RPG Site on social media. Just search for RPG space site and you should be able to find us. Bookmark our homepage, rpgsite.net. Comment like all of our features, like the Neverwinter Nights 2 enhanced review. We've got the No Sleep for Konami Date review up on the site. We've got James's CyberConnect 2 feature up on the site. Follow us or join the Discord, discord.gg/rpgsite. And we'll be back next week with another episode of the TetraCast. So until you hear from us then, stay safe, take care, and we'll talk to y'all later.